And one of our favorite guests here on Coast to Coast, Graham Hancock with us, of course, noted author, his home run book, Fingerprints of the Gods. We're going to be back with Graham and talk about that and so many other incredible issues in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you on Coast to Coast. And, of course, as I mentioned, one of our favorite guests, Graham Hancock, with us. Graham, of course, is an incredible thinker. He raises questions about humanity's history and prehistory. He graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. He went on to pursue a career in journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers, and now has really concentrated his career on the mysteries of the universe. And, of course, let's welcome Graham Hancock. Always a pleasure, Graham. How are you?
I'm very well, George. Thank you. It's really good to hear your voice and to talk to you again.
I'm looking forward to this. And, you know, when you were writing for the newspapers, did you still have an eye of interest on the unusual and the mysteries that you've written about today?
I think I certainly had an eye of interest on the unusual, but it was the unusual within the frame of reference of current affairs. I was very focused on current affairs for the first 15 years of my career as a writer, say from the age of about 22 to 37. The current affairs were my main interest, and I didn't really switch on to historical mysteries. It was an accidental encounter in Ethiopia in 1983 that first tweaked my interest, but it took another 4 years of background research on that historical mystery, which concerned Ethiopia's claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant, before my focus really began to shift from current affairs to ancient mysteries. And what I realized was that the field of ancient mysteries was a field in which very few people were working and very little curiosity was being shown. The mainstream historians and archaeologists had that field to themselves. And I felt that here was an area where I would have something independent and something different to say. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people working in journalism. Who needs another journalist, you know? But real serious investigation from an alternative point of view of the mysteries of our past was relatively rare.
And once you started investigating some of these mysteries of the past, wasn't it amazing for you to see some of the things that you came across, some of the things you discovered? You could look, for example, in Genesis, and if you could interpret it the correct way and then match it up with many of the things that you've discovered over the years, Graham, it's truly uncanny, isn't it?
It's a very uncanny business. I mean, the Old Testament of the Bible is actually full of intriguing, mysterious texts. It's an extraordinary book. It's an extraordinary record of our remote past, and parts of it go back very, very far indeed. I mean, there are very curious references. There's a reference in Genesis, for example, to the fear that, quote unquote, God feels, the fear that he feels at the prospect of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of life. And then the line goes in the book of Genesis, lest they become gods like us, as though if they eat of this tree of life, that there's not just one God, there's multiple gods. And that seems to go completely against the ethic of monotheism that we're taught is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian religions. And then, very intriguing to me, the book of Exodus and the building of the Ark of the Covenant that is described in the book of Exodus, where Moses goes up Mount Sinai and meets God face to face, and we're told that ever afterwards Moses' face shines with a radiance as though he's been burnt. He reflects some sort of heat, some sort of luminescence, and he's given what reads almost like a scientific blueprint for building the Ark of the Covenant, a very, very detailed description on the basis of which we could at least construct a physical simulacrum of the Ark of the Covenant today. And as a matter of fact, I know a few people who've done so, although they've not managed to energize it with the mysterious power of the Ark of the Covenant that's described in the Bible. So these texts are fascinating. And when I began to research the Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia back in the 1980s, it was texts like that text in Exodus that made me wonder if we were dealing with some sort of out-of-place technological artifact in the Ark of the Covenant, something we're taught that there was no technology at that time, that it was a very simple, primitive time. And yet we have this object that strikes people dead with bolts of fire, that flies through the air, that Moses is able to use as a radio for talking to God. The whole thing is very intriguing. And you know, either we're to dismiss all of this as the fantasies of ancient scribes, or we're to consider the possibility that there's a real mystery here. And I've always been open to that possibility.
Me too. I mean, something I think really happened, and they probably tried to describe it, Graham, as yeah. good as they could for what they could understand.
If
the ancients, for example, saw a submarine, it'd be very interesting to see how they try to describe it.
Exactly, or an aircraft. How would that be described? If you don't have the technological reference frame, then you're going to use all kinds of metaphors and synonyms to describe this thing. And so it's that kind of symbolic language that we have to sift through in the ancient text. But of course, if we come at the ancient texts from the perspective of mainstream archaeology or history, then we wouldn't even be looking for any of that there. We would already be fixed in the idea that the ancient texts are simply myth, fantasy, and superstition. And I think that's one of the mistakes that history makes. I think we have this huge archive of written materials from our remote past, and I think we should keep an open mind as to what those materials are referring us to.
When Moses came down with the Ten Commandments and he had this radiated look on his face, does that describe, do you think, an encounter with perhaps an ET and a craft where maybe he was radiated?
I've never felt that it was necessary to leap to that conclusion when we have a simpler and more direct possibility at hand, which is that Moses, as an individual who was reared in the household of the Pharaoh of ancient Egypt, who was initiated into the high science of ancient Egypt. Let's not forget that where do we get the word chemistry from? You know, the ancient name for Egypt was Kemet, and the Arabs later called Egypt Al-Kemt. From that word, we get alchemy, and from Kemet, we get our own word, chemistry. And this is a recognition that the ancient Egyptians were masters of a certain kind of arcane science. And what I've always felt we need to look at first, before we start jumping to conclusions about aliens, I'm not against aliens at all, and I'm sure that the many, many planets out there in deep interstellar space are inhabited with intelligent life. I just have no doubt about that at all. But when we look at the mysteries of planet Earth, I think the first thing we should consider is the possibility of a lost human civilization, of an earlier civilization that reached a high level of technology and was lost to history in some way. And the conclusion I came to is that Moses was the inheritor of a tradition from a lost civilization, which included the ability to create what we would regard as technological artifacts. And I tend to see the Ark of the Covenant in that light rather than in the light of some sort of alien intervention. And it's interesting, there's a very clear description of the Ark of the Covenant striking the Philistines dead. It's a little bit later in the biblical story, after the Israelites have entered the Promised Land, and they're carrying the ark, and it's used as an instrument of battle. And it's briefly captured by the Philistines and taken to the city of Ashdod. And there, the Philistines make the mistake of opening the ark. Now, the construction of the ark is interesting because it consists of a layer of gold with a layer of wood inside that, and that wood is described as acacia wood. And inside the wood is another layer of gold. So it's a series of internested boxes, like one of those Russian dolls.
Yeah.
And it was always a mistake to open the ark. The ark was covered with a thick golden lid upon which perched these figures of two cherubim with their wings sweeping together over the center of the lid, and it was often described as a light or a radiance between those wings. But it was strictly forbidden to open the Ark of the Covenant, and the Philistines opened it and put it on display as a kind of tourist object. And we're told that 50,000 Philistines passed by it and gazed into it, and they all then die, according to the biblical text, and they die of cancerous tumors, as though they've been exposed to some kind of radiation source that was shielded by the gold in the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, because gold is a fantastic radiation shield. Now, I don't see why we have to jump to the conclusion that that is an extraterrestrial object. It could be. I'm not going to completely rule that out, but I would like to focus first on perhaps an easier, more direct, simpler conclusion, which is that we may be dealing with a legacy from a lost human civilization. And there's just so much evidence for the possibility that we have lost part of our story, that we're what I call a species with amnesia, that there was an earlier episode of high civilization on Earth. And, you know, if we can explain the mysteries of the past in terms of a lost human civilization, then why should we look into interstellar space in order to explain those mysteries? We might need to explain some of today's mysteries by looking into interstellar space, but my problem is that I've yet to see, and I've spent the last 25-plus years traveling around the world looking at ancient monuments, and I know that this may disappoint or annoy some listeners, but I have yet to see in all my years of traveling around this planet and investigating some of the most incredible ancient sites all around the world, I've yet to see a single ancient site that I need aliens to explain. See, if I need to explain, let's take the most fantastic mystery of the ancient world, the Great Pyramid of Giza. It is just the most incredible technological object in its own right. If that was built by entities that had the technology to cross interstellar space. I mean, consider the technology to cross interstellar space. We ourselves do not have that technology yet. To cross interstellar space, you've got to be very, very advanced technologically. Now, when you look at the Great Pyramid, it is a stunning work of construction, but there are little mistakes in it. For example, its side lengths are about 750 feet long. Each side varies from the length of the other side by as much as 7 inches. That's a tiny variation in human terms, very tiny, but it is an error. The Great Pyramid is not perfect. Each side is not exactly the same length. The Great Pyramid is almost perfectly aligned to true north. It's just 3/60ths of a degree off true north. That's uncanny precision for human beings to have made thousands and thousands of years ago, and suggests a lost construction technology. But it's not the kind of precision that I would expect from beings who had mastered the technology to cross interstellar space.
Good point. That's why
when I look at the Great Pyramid, my logical mind considers first the possibility of a lost human civilization before it jumps to the conclusion that I'm looking at the work of alien beings who had the technology to cross interstellar space. Because if they could cross interstellar space, they would get the side lengths of the Great Pyramid identically the same, and they would align it up precisely to true north, not 3/60ths of a degree off true north.
In this lost civilization, they could have had the capability of flying. You know, for all we know, they may have gone into space. Maybe they went to the moon. You know,
They went to the moon. There's much to suggest in ancient texts and traditions from all over the world. Most famously from the Vedic texts of ancient India, but we can find similar accounts in the ancient Egyptian texts. There's much to suggest that at some point in human prehistory, some culture had the ability to fly. And indeed, it's quite well known that there's a very curious little object in the Cairo Museum. The ancient Egyptians made models of everything, and they made models of birds. and filed in a cabinet which contains about 20 models of different kinds of birds is something that clearly is not a bird, which has straight wings, a vertical tail, the wings have an aerofoil section. This object has been wind tunnel tested and proves to be highly aerodynamic. It is, in fact, a model aeroplane, and it was removed from a tomb at Saqqara, about 15 miles south of Giza, and is thousands of years old. So it's a real mystery as to what it's doing there and why the technology to create a flying aircraft is perfectly expressed in this little model aircraft that was found in ancient Egypt. It does suggest that the ability to fly was present in the past. And of course, we have fantastic accounts of flying machines, the famous vimanas from the ancient Indian tradition, and these machines even deploying deadly weapons involved in aerial warfare. So again, we have a number of options. We can think this might be aliens. We can think this might be the fantasies of the ancient scribes, or we can think that a lost episode of high civilization is memorialized in these ancient texts. And that's the particular line of inquiry that I've followed. I don't mean to put down other people's lines of inquiry, and they're welcome to it. I think we all have something to bring to the table. And what I've been trying to do is to focus on the possibility that we may have lost a whole civilization from the human record.
And maybe several times, Graham.
Maybe several times. This is another factor which needs to be borne into account. And indeed, there's evidence for that. I've recently been in the Andes in South America, and there's evidence there for more than one ancient lost civilization in very different and distinct construction techniques that a local expert called Jesus Gamara showed me there. It's very, very clear that we're not looking at just one episode. We're looking at many. And this is why I think we also need to keep into account the possibility, the role that cataclysms have played in the human story, that perhaps everything is not smooth running on this planet all the time, that perhaps there are terrible episodes of geological disaster, of impacts with asteroids and comets from outer space, which have reset the clock of human civilization and made us almost go back to square one, as Plato put it in the story of Atlantis, have forced us to begin again like children with no memory of what went before. And every time I read that passage from Plato, it gives me the chills, this notion that we lose our memory and have to start again.
I mean, if we were obliterated to the point where some of us survived, Graham, but I got to tell you, I've got some strengths and I've got a lot of weaknesses, and I could not electronically wire something up or do something. I would be back into the Stone Ages because I couldn't do that.
Me too. And you know what, George? We wouldn't know how to be good Stone Age people either.
No,
that's the problem. I mean, if you're really a Stone Age person, if you're at that level of technological development, if our Earth were hit by a giant comet today and our technological civilization collapsed, and I fear that it could easily collapse. It's extremely fragile. It's based on multiple interlocked specialisms. Nobody is in command today. Very few people are in command today of all the skills necessary to maintain a technological society. We all depend on one another. And if that network breaks down, we would very rapidly fall back into a primitive state of living. And we in the technological West do not have Stone Age skills. We only know how to live in a highly technological society. We do not have the skills to survive in difficult and very basic situations. As a matter of fact, the people on the Earth...
Hold on for a second, Graham. We're going to hit the break, and we're going to come right back. Talk more with you, Graham Hancock, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, please take a moment and watch our television program, Beyond Belief. I'll tell you how you can do that. But more importantly, this week, Jerome Corsi is talking about the JFK assassination on Beyond Belief, so take advantage of it. 10 days free to look at that program and look at as much as you can. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with Graham Hancock, special three-hour program with Graham tonight. Graham, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the technology and the lost civilization, and then we'll get into, of course, some of your incredible writings.
Thank you. Just to pick up on the last thought we were at, though, while it's still in my mind, because it's an interesting point. We were talking about, you know, your ability to survive in the world today, and indeed my ability, that we are people who depend a lot on the technology of modern civilization. And the point I was just going to make before the break is actually, if our civilization were struck down by some global disaster, the people who would actually survive in the world today are people like the Kalahari Bushmen in southern Africa, or some of the tribes in the Amazon jungle, who have mastered all the skills for surviving at a very basic level and who have all the resources they need in order to survive. And we in advanced technological society have lost those skills. Of course, there are a few people training in survival skills, and maybe that's a really good idea. So, you know, I think the notion that a technology can be lost is something that we should confront, and we should realize that it can very easily happen to us.
And probably will again, no doubt. Graham, 18-plus years ago, you rocked this planet with the Fingerprints of the Gods, and you're working on some other sequels to that as well. Tell me what's
been
going on.
Well, I'm going to write a sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, and I've been working on that already for the past year. And that book will be, provisionally, it's called Magicians of the Gods. That may change. And it won't be published until the fall of 2015. I'm due to deliver it to the publishers at the end of 2014. But the reason that I'm writing a sequel is because there is a lot of new evidence. I'm not intending to do an update of Fingerprints of the Gods. I think Fingerprints of the Gods is a document in its own right, which I'm glad to say people still find useful to refer to after nearly 20 years. And that book is there, and it's still in print, and I don't intend to change a word of that. But what I intend to do is to write a whole new book, reviewing new evidence that has come up, which reactivates reawakens my curiosity in the possibilities I examined in Fingerprints of the Gods.
Graham, give some of our new listeners who haven't had an opportunity to read Fingerprints of the Gods a little highlight of what that was all about.
Right. Well, Fingerprints of the Gods, the subtitle is The Evidence of Earth's Lost Civilization. And what the book does is it looks at a whole range of mysteries and problems. It opens, for example, with a section on ancient maps, that there are these maps that have come down to us. Now, most of them were drawn in historical times. They were drawn in, say, 1500 or 1600 AD, 400 or 500 years ago. But when we look at the background to these maps, we find that the often famous map makers, such as Admiral Piri Reis or Mercator or Orontius Phineus, who made these maps, tell us that they based them on older source maps, which have not come down to us. And they often state that they had found these old maps in various archives, that the old maps were in a very fragile condition, worm-eaten, falling apart, literally crumbling away. And they decided to preserve the information on those maps by copying them onto new paper and creating basically a copy of an older source map. The older source map is now lost to us. And when we look at this category of maps, which include many maps from the so-called Portolan tradition and some from the Ptolemaic tradition, when we look at this category of maps, we find that it includes information which should not be there. Most strikingly and most intriguingly to me, the continent of Antarctica is shown on many of these maps. You can look at lots of maps from the 15 and 1600s which show Antarctica in considerable detail. But the only error in it is that it seems to be much larger than Antarctica is today. But that turns out not to be an error, because here's the thing. Our civilization didn't discover Antarctica until the year 1818. So any appearance of Antarctica on a map before 1818 is deeply puzzling. and it doesn't. We really can't explain it in terms of Orthodox history. And what these maps of Antarctica suggest is that our Earth was mapped by some seafaring civilization with a considerable degree of accuracy during the last ice age, when Antarctica was indeed much bigger than it is today, and when it looked exactly as it looks on those ancient maps. So this raises the hair-raising possibility that there was, at the time which we think of as the Upper Paleolithic, as the Stone Age, more than 12,000 years ago, going back to 20,000 years ago or more, when the Earth was plunged deep in the Ice Age, when sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today, when a huge swathe of North America was covered in a 2-mile thick ice cap, and the same was true in Northern Europe, when the world looked very different, that somebody was mapping the world then and was doing it with a high degree of accuracy, and that somehow some of those maps survived through into historical times when they were copied by known map makers, and thus the information in them was passed down to us. So I have a whole section on these ancient maps, and what these ancient maps suggest to me is that there was a civilization capable, A, of exploring, and B, of mapping with good latitude and longitude references the whole planet deep in the Ice Age, perhaps as much as 20,000 years ago. And again, when I look at these maps, the accuracy is very good, but it is not the level of accuracy that you would display if you could cross interstellar space. It looks like human workmanship, but human workmanship of a standard that is far beyond anything that we would imagine from 20,000 years ago, when our ancestors are supposed all to have been primitive hunter-gatherers. And therefore, what it suggests to me is a forgotten episode in human history. And then, from that section of the Fingerprints of the Gods, I went on to travel all around the world and to describe the myths and traditions of a global flood, that there was some kind of gigantic global cataclysm. And almost everywhere we encounter this tradition, the story of Atlantis is just one example of that tradition, but even the biblical flood of Noah is another example of that tradition. Everywhere we encounter this tradition, there's a reference to a former golden age, to a higher level of civilization, which is brought to a sudden, a dramatic and devastating end by a global cataclysm. And it's often suggested that that civilization has fallen, has angered the gods, or has fallen out of harmony with the universe in some way, and this is why it's punished by the cataclysm. And then we get accounts of what read to me like survivors, of men and women who go around the world trying to, in a time of darkness, trying to reestablish civilization. And I look at those traditions, and I look at monuments that have come down from that time.
Graham, back to the ancient map makers for a moment. What kind of instrumentation do you think they had in order to do what they did?
Well, to do these maps, you would need, which document the world as it looked 20,000 years ago, you would need the level of technology that our civilization only began to master in the late 1700s and early 1800s. You would need 19th century level of technology. I'm not saying you would need 21st century level of technology, but you would need the ability to show not only accurate latitudes, which is a relatively straightforward thing to do, but also accurate longitudes. Now, I'm sorry, this is a little bit technical, but to do longitude, you need accurate clocks. And the reason why, until the very late 1700s and early 1800s, the reason why our civilization could not do longitude. See, the problem of longitude was a gigantic problem for seafarers in the 1600s, because they never knew how far east or west they were of a particular point. They couldn't tell accurately. And that meant that they would have shipping disasters. They would crash into a coastline that they didn't expect to see. And there were huge prizes offered for anybody who could crack the problem of longitude. And what you need to crack the problem of longitude fundamentally is an accurate clock which will work at sea. It's not just that the clock should be accurate, it should be able to work perfectly at sea, and it should keep the time in your home port, and then you can work out how far east or west you are of a particular point. And it's just a fact of history that our civilization was not able to produce marine chronometers with that level of accuracy until the late 1700s or the early 1800s. And that's when we ourselves began to map the world accurately and began to be able to reproduce the level of accuracy that is shown in these maps from perhaps as much as 20,000 years ago, and I say 20,000 years ago because they show the world as we know it looked 20,000 years ago. And this is the mystery, and this is why I feel the best solution to that mystery is a lost human civilization, the kind of high civilization that is spoken of in many myths and traditions. But in order to make those maps, the level of technology they would have needed was the kind of technology we had in the early 18th century. It isn't a very, very high technology, but it's amazingly high technology for 20,000 years ago when we're supposed to have been primitive cavemen, you know.
Well, and you're right, too, because if it happened to have been ET technology gazing at us from above, the maps would have been pristine.
They'd have been pristine, and they'd have been absolutely perfect.
Yes.
In every degree. Instead, we get this amazing quality, which is far out of place in time, but is not absolutely perfect. And that's what I see, as I mentioned in the last segment, in the Great Pyramid as well, which has to stand out as perhaps the ultimate monument of the ancient world. Incredible precision, and yet it is not the level of precision that we would expect of beings who were capable of crossing interstellar space. You don't make little errors. You don't get your side lengths mismatching by as much as 7 inches. You don't fail to make your alignment perfect to true north. The Great Pyramid, as I mentioned, is just 3/60 of a single degree off true north. That's stunning accuracy when you're talking about a 6-million-ton monument with a 13-acre footprint that's 481 feet high. But it's still an error. And if you can cross, if you can navigate interstellar space to the point where you can go from one planet to another across interstellar space, you don't make even an error of 3/60 of a degree. You get it spot on. And that's why I think this is human workmanship that we're looking at here, but it's uncanny human workmanship. And it bears witness to the truth of the ancient myths all around the world that speak of a lost human civilization.
You know, when you came out with fingerprints and you came out with your theories of these ancient lost civilizations, did you run into any controversy with some of your scholars and peers?
Yes, absolutely. I was subjected to the most withering and vicious attacks. And I think anybody who works in the field of an alternative interpretation of the human condition will sooner or later find themselves under such attack if their work becomes prominent. You see, my great crime, as far as the mainstream academics were concerned, was not only that I presented an alternative view of history quite different from their own, but also that my book succeeded, that actually millions of people around the world bought and read and reacted to Fingerprints of the Gods. If Fingerprints of the Gods had simply vanished without a trace, if it had got, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 readers and there'd been no further interest, if it had gone out of print after a year or two, then there would have been no attacks on me. My great crime was that my book became prominent and popular. And for that reason, I had to be attacked because archaeology professors were getting questions from their students in class about why they were telling the story of ancient Egypt in one way, when here was Hancock, who was suggesting a totally alternative view of the history of ancient Egypt. And I'm proud to say that those questions are still being asked in university classes today, because Fingerprints has found a whole new generation of readers in the curious and open-minded youth who refuse to put up with the party line that has been fed to them by mainstream academia, and who are open to the possibility of mystery in the past. So yes, I was enormously attacked, and the attack started with academics themselves, and then they went on to their friends in the mainstream media and got them to attack me as well. And for a while, I did feel very persecuted. It was only later that I began to understand that this is the way academics work, that they actually also attack one another in this way. They are like a furious pack of attack dogs, actually. And the whole system of academia is based on destructive criticism. Confronted with a new idea, your first reaction as an academic is not to seek what may be worthy or valuable in that idea, but to seek to destroy that idea utterly and to destroy the individual who has presented that idea. And I suppose the reasoning is that if the idea can survive these violent and vicious attacks, which are often extremely underhand and use the techniques of propaganda in the way they're presented, if the idea can survive these attacks, then it may turn out to be the case that there is some merit in that idea. And that's, I'm pleased to say, what seems to have happened with Fingerprints of the Gods, because Fingerprints of the Gods has been continuously in print for close to 20 years now. It has survived those attacks. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not even claiming that I'm right. I'm simply offering an alternative point of view, and that alternative point of view has some resonance, and it is beginning to be supported by whole swathes of new evidence that were not available in 1995 when I published the book. And this is what is interesting. This is what changes scientific ideas ultimately. It's new evidence that overwhelms the existing paradigm and makes the existing paradigm no longer acceptable. We begin to realize that we need a new reference frame. Just as for centuries it was believed that the sun revolved around the earth, seemed to make perfect sense. You get up in the morning, you see the sun, and you see it rise through the sky descend on the other side of the sky. It looks like it revolves around the earth, and for centuries that was the belief, that the sun revolved around the earth. And anybody who suggested that these observations were actually produced by the earth revolving around the sun were actually killed and burnt at the stake. But eventually, observations of the heavens, particularly with the introduction of telescopes and the ability to observe distant planets, eventually these observations overwhelmed that old bad idea, and we began to understand that the earth is not the center of everything, that the sun does not revolve around the earth, but rather that the earth and all the planets revolve around the sun. So it was new evidence that overwhelmed the old bad paradigm, and that's what I see beginning to happen now, 20 years after I published Fingerprints of the Gods, with the possibility of a lost civilization, that new evidence for a lost civilization is coming up, and it is going to make the old idea of history increasingly unacceptable to anybody with a reasonable mind.
Graham, thank God you weren't around during that era, because they would have stoned you for your beliefs.
Could be stoned to death, could be burnt at the stake. You see, the thing is, there's something about we humans, which is that we, in some weird way, we don't like change. We like the stability of the status quo. We like things the way they are. And a suggestion that the things the way they are is wrong can be deeply disturbing to huge quantities of people, and seems to disturb. Then it's not just at the level of ideas, it seems to fundamentally threaten their existence. And this explains the intense hostility of the academic reaction to an alternative idea of history, that if they've got it wrong all these years about history, then everything is wrong in their world. And that's such an upsetting idea that it produces this huge reaction and fight reaction on the part of academics, and all we can do is just persist. And I'm not alone. I have many amazing colleagues in this field: Randon Rose Flemath, Robert Boval, John Anthony West, Professor Robert Schock at Boston University, who is a mainstream academic but takes an alternative
Michael Cremo,
doing fantastic work on the deep antiquity of human technology. Many of us are working in this field, slowly working away and pursuing our own lines of inquiry, and those lines of inquiry are all converging on the possibility that we have indeed lost at least one and possibly several major episodes of the human story.
Graham, when we come back in a moment, I want to talk with you a little bit more about this catastrophic flood that, of course, was reported in Genesis as the flood of Noah. I want to get your take on that. A few more questions about the Ark of the Covenant. And, of course, then we'll get into some of the new evidence that's going to allow you to do the sequel, The Fingerprints of the Gods. And we'll go through each one of those forms of evidence. It's riveting. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment. Graham Hancock with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. And one of our favorite guests here on Coast to Coast, Graham Hancock with us, of course, noted author, his home run book, Fingerprints of the Gods. We're going to be back with Graham and talk about that and so many other incredible issues in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. George Norrie back with you on Coast to Coast. And, of course, as I mentioned, one of our favorite guests, Graham Hancock, with us. Graham, of course, is an incredible thinker. He raises questions about humanity's history and prehistory. graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. He went on to pursue a career in journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers, and now has really concentrated his career on the mysteries of the universe. And, of course, let's welcome Graham Hancock. Always a pleasure, Graham. How are you?
I'm very well, George. Thank you. It's really good to hear your voice and to talk to you again.
I'm looking forward to this. And, you know, when you were writing for the newspapers, did you still have an eye of interest on the unusual and the mysteries that you've written about today?
I think I certainly had an eye of interest on the unusual, but it was the unusual within the frame of reference of current affairs. I was very focused on current affairs for the first 15 years of my career as a writer, say from the age of about 22 to 37. Current affairs were my main interest, and I didn't really switch on to historical mysteries. It was an accidental encounter in Ethiopia in 1983 that first tweaked my interest, but it took another 4 years of background research on that historical mystery, which concerned Ethiopia's claim to possess the Ark of the Covenant, before my focus really began to shift from current affairs to ancient mysteries. And what I realized was that the field of ancient mysteries was a field in which very few people were working and very little curiosity was being shown. The mainstream historians and archaeologists had that field to themselves. And I felt that here was an area where I would have something independent and something different to say. I mean, there's tens of thousands of people working in journalism. Who needs another journalist, you know? But real serious investigation from an alternative point of view of the mysteries of our past was relatively rare.
And once you started investigating some of these mysteries of the past, wasn't it amazing for you to see some of the things that you came across, some of the things you discovered? You could look, for example, in Genesis, and if you could interpret it the correct way and then match it up with many of the things that you've discovered over the years, Graham, it's truly uncanny, isn't it?
It's a very uncanny business. I mean, the Old Testament of the Bible is actually full of intriguing, mysterious texts. It's an extraordinary book. It's an extraordinary record of our remote past, and parts of it go back very, very far indeed. I mean, there are very curious references. There's a reference in Genesis, for example, to the fear that, quote unquote, God feels, the fear that he feels at the prospect of Adam and Eve eating from the tree of life. And then the line goes in the book of Genesis, lest they become gods like us, as though if they eat of this tree of life, that there's not just one God, there's multiple gods. And that seems to go completely against the ethic of monotheism that we're taught is at the heart of the Judeo-Christian religions. And then, very intriguing to me, the book of Exodus and the building of the Ark of the Covenant that is described in the book of Exodus, where Moses goes up Mount Sinai and meets God face to face, and we're told that ever afterwards Moses' face shines with a radiance as though he's been burnt. He reflects some sort of heat, some sort of luminescence, and he's given what reads almost like a scientific blueprint for building the Ark of the Covenant. It's a very, very detailed description on the basis of which we could at least construct a physical simulacrum of the Ark of the Covenant today. And as a matter of fact, I know a few people who've done so, although they've not managed to energize it with the mysterious power of the Ark of the Covenant that's described in the Bible. So these texts are fascinating. And when I began to research the Ark of the Covenant in Ethiopia back in the 1980s, it was texts like that text in Exodus that made me wonder if we were dealing with some sort of out-of-place technological artifact in the Ark of the Covenant, something we're taught that there was no technology at that time, but it was a very simple, primitive time. And yet we have this object that strikes people dead with bolts of fire, that flies through the air, that Moses is able to use as a radio for talking to God. The whole thing is very intriguing. And you know, either we're to dismiss all of this as the fantasies of ancient scribes, or we're to consider the possibility that there's a real mystery here. And I've always been open to that possibility.
Me too. I mean, something I think really happened, and they probably tried to describe it, Graham, as yeah. good as they could for what they could understand.
If
the ancients, for example, saw a submarine, it'd be very interesting to see how they try to describe it.
Exactly, or an aircraft. How would that be described? If you don't have the technological reference frame, then you're going to use all kinds of metaphors and synonyms to describe this thing. And so it's that kind of symbolic language that we have to sift through in the ancient texts. But of course, if we come at the ancient texts from the perspective of mainstream archaeology or history, then we wouldn't even be looking for any of that there. We would already be fixed in the idea that the ancient texts are simply myth, fantasy, and superstition. And I think that's one of the mistakes that history makes. I think we have this huge archive of written materials from our remote past, and I think we should keep an open mind as to what those materials are referring us to.
When Moses came down with the Ten Commandments and he had this radiated look on his face, does that describe, do you think, an encounter with perhaps an ET and a craft where maybe he was radiated?
I've never felt that it was necessary to leap to that conclusion when we have a simpler and more direct possibility at hand, which is that Moses, as an individual who was reared in the household of the Pharaoh of ancient Egypt, who was initiated into the high science of ancient Egypt. Let's not forget that where do we get the word chemistry from? You know, the ancient name for Egypt was Kemet, and the Arabs later called Egypt Al-Kemt. From that word, we get alchemy, and from Kemet, we get our own word chemistry. And this is a recognition that the ancient Egyptians were masters of a certain kind of arcane science. And what I've always felt we need to look at first, before we start jumping to conclusions about aliens, I'm not against aliens at all, and I'm sure that the many, many planets out there in deep interstellar space are inhabited with intelligent life. I just have no doubt about that at all. But when we look at the mysteries of planet Earth, I think the first thing we should consider is the possibility of a lost human civilization, of an earlier civilization that reached a high level of technology and was lost to history in some way. And the conclusion I came to is that Moses was the inheritor of a tradition from a lost civilization, which included the ability to create what we would regard as technological artifacts. And I tend to see the Ark of the Covenant in that light rather than in the light of some sort of alien intervention. And it's interesting, there's a very clear description of the Ark of the Covenant striking the Philistines dead. It's a little bit later in the biblical story, after the Israelites have entered the Promised Land, and they're carrying the Ark, and it's used as an instrument of battle. And it's briefly captured by the Philistines and taken to the city of Ashdod. And there, the Philistines make the mistake of opening the Ark. Now, the construction of the Ark is interesting because it consists of a layer of gold with a layer of wood inside that, and that wood is described as acacia wood, and inside the wood is another layer of gold. So it's a series of internested boxes, like one of those Russian dolls.
Yeah.
And it was always a mistake to open the Ark. The Ark was covered with a thick golden lid upon which perched these figures of two cherubim with their wings sweeping together over the center of the lid, and it was often described as a light or a radiance between those wings. But it was strictly forbidden to open the Ark of the Covenant, and the Philistines opened it and put it on display as a kind of tourist object. And we're told that 50,000 Philistines passed by it and gazed into it, and they all then die, according to the biblical text, and they die of cancerous tumors, as though they've been exposed to some kind of radiation source that was shielded by the gold in the construction of the Ark of the Covenant, because gold is a fantastic radiation shield. Now, I don't see why we have to jump to the conclusion that that is an extraterrestrial object. It could be. I'm not going to completely rule that out, but I would like to focus first on perhaps an easier, more direct, simpler conclusion, which is that we may be dealing with a legacy from a lost human civilization. And there's just so much evidence for the possibility that we have lost part of our story, that we're what I call a species with amnesia, that there was an earlier episode of high civilization on Earth. And, you know, if we can explain the mysteries of the past in terms of a lost human civilization, then why should we look into interstellar space in order to explain those mysteries? We might need to explain some of today's mysteries by looking into interstellar space, but my problem is that I've yet to see, and I've spent the last 25-plus years traveling around the world looking at ancient monuments, and I know that this may disappoint or annoy some listeners, but I have yet to see in all my years of traveling around this planet and investigating some of the most incredible ancient sites all around the world, I've yet to see a single ancient site that I need aliens to explain. See, if I need to explain, let's take the most fantastic mystery of the ancient world, the Great Pyramid of Giza. It is just the most incredible technological object in its own right. If that was built by entities that had the technology to cross interstellar space. I mean, consider the technology to cross interstellar space. We ourselves do not have that technology yet. To cross interstellar space, you've got to be very, very advanced technologically. Now, when you look at the Great Pyramid, it is a stunning work of construction, but there are little mistakes in it. For example, its side lengths are about 750 feet long. Each side varies from the length of the other side by as much as 7 inches. That's a tiny variation in human terms, very tiny, but it is an error. The Great Pyramid is not perfect. Each side is not exactly the same length. The Great Pyramid is almost perfectly aligned to true north. It's just 3/60ths of a degree off true north. That's uncanny precision for human beings to have made thousands and thousands of years ago, and suggests a lost construction technology. But it's not the kind of precision that I would expect from beings who had mastered the technology to cross interstellar space.
Good point. That's why
when I look at the Great Pyramid, my logical mind considers first the possibility of a lost human civilization before it jumps to the conclusion that I'm looking at the work of alien beings who had the technology to cross interstellar space. Because if they could cross interstellar space, they would get the side lengths of the Great Pyramid identically the same, and they would align it up precisely to true north, not 3/60ths of a degree off true north.
In this lost civilization, they could have had the capability of flying. You know, for all we know, they may have gone into space. Maybe they went to the moon. You know,
They went to the moon. There's much to suggest in ancient texts and traditions from all over the world, most famously from the Vedic texts of ancient India, but we can find similar accounts in the ancient Egyptian texts. There's much to suggest that at some point in human prehistory, some culture had the ability to fly. And indeed, it's quite well known that there's a very curious little object in the Cairo Museum. The ancient Egyptians made models of everything, and they made models of birds and filed in a cabinet which contains about 20 models of different kinds of birds is something that clearly is not a bird, which has straight wings, a vertical tail, The wings have an aerofoil section. This object has been wind tunnel tested and proves to be highly aerodynamic. It is, in fact, a model aeroplane. And it was removed from a tomb at Saqqara, about 15 miles south of Giza, and is thousands of years old. So it's a real mystery as to what it's doing there and why the technology to create a flying aircraft is perfectly expressed in this little model aircraft that was found in ancient Egypt. It does suggest that the ability to fly was present in the past. And of course, we have fantastic accounts of flying machines, the famous vimanas from the ancient Indian tradition, and these machines even deploying deadly weapons involved in aerial warfare. So again, we have a number of options. We can think this might be aliens. We can think this might be the fantasies of the ancient scribes, or we can think that a lost episode of high civilization is memorialized in these ancient texts. And that's the particular line of inquiry that I've followed. I don't mean to put down other people's lines of inquiry, and they're welcome to it. I think we all have something to bring to the table. And what I've been trying to do is to focus on the possibility that we may have lost a whole civilization from the human record.
And maybe several times, Graham.
Maybe several times. This is another factor which needs to be borne into account. And indeed, there's evidence for that. I've recently been in the Andes in South America, and there's evidence there for more than one ancient lost civilization in very different and distinct construction techniques that a local expert called Jesus Gamara showed me there. It's very, very clear that we're not looking at just one episode. We're looking at many. And this is why I think we also need to keep into account the possibility, the role that cataclysms have played in the human story, that perhaps everything is not smooth running on this planet all the time, that perhaps there are terrible episodes of geological disaster, of impacts with asteroids and comets from outer space, which have reset the clock of human civilization and made us almost go back to square one, as Plato put it in the story of Atlantis, have forced us to begin again like children with no memory of what went before. And every time I read that passage from Plato, it gives me the chills, this notion that we lose our memory and have to start again.
I mean, if we were obliterated to the point where some of us survived, Graham, but I mean, I got to tell you, I've got some strengths and I've got a lot of weaknesses, and I could not electronically wire something up or do something. I would be back into the Stone Ages because I couldn't do that.
Me too. And you know what, George? We wouldn't know how to be good Stone Age people either.
No,
that's the problem. I mean, if you're really a Stone Age person, if you're at that level of technological development, if our Earth were hit by a giant comet today and our technological civilization collapsed, and I fear that it could easily collapse. It's extremely fragile. It's based on multiple interlocked specialisms. Nobody is in command today. Very few people are in command today of all the skills necessary to maintain a technological society. We all depend on one another. And if that network breaks down, we would very rapidly fall back into a primitive state of living. And we in the technological West do not have Stone Age skills. We only know how to live in a highly technological society. We do not have the skills to survive in difficult and very basic situations. As a matter of fact, the people on the Earth...
Hold on for a second, Graham. We're going to hit the break, and we're going to come right back, talk more with you, Graham Hancock, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, please take a moment and watch our television program, Beyond Belief. I'll tell you how you can do that, but more importantly... This week, Jerome Corsi is talking about the JFK assassination on Beyond Belief. So take advantage of it. 10 days free to look at that program and look at as much as you can. Simply go to the website, beyondbelief.com. Welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with Graham Hancock, special 3-hour program with Graham tonight. Graham, I want to talk with you a little bit more about the technology and the lost civilization, and then we'll get into, of course, some of your incredible writings.
Thank you. Just to pick up on the last thought we were at, though, while it's still in my mind, because it's an interesting point. We were talking about, you know, your ability to survive in the world today, and indeed my ability, that we are people who depend a lot on the technology of modern civilization. And the point I was just going to make before the break is actually if our civilization were struck down by some global disaster, the people who would actually survive in the world today are people like the Kalahari Bushmen in southern Africa, or some of the tribes in the Amazon jungle, who have mastered all the skills for surviving at a very basic level and who have all the resources they need in order to survive. And we in advanced technological society have lost those skills. Of course, there are a few people training in survival skills, and maybe that's a really good idea. So, you know, I think the notion that a technology can be lost is something that we should confront, and we should realize that it can very easily happen to us.
And probably will again. No
doubt.
Yeah. No doubt. Graham, 18 plus years ago, you rocked this planet with the fingerprints of the gods.
Yeah.
And you're working on some other sequels to that as well. Tell me what's going on.
Well, I'm going to write a sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods, and I've been working on that already for the past year. And that book will be, provisionally it's called Magicians of the Gods, that may change, and it won't be published until the fall of 2015. I'm due to deliver it to the publishers at the end of 2014. But the reason that I'm writing a sequel is because there is a lot of new evidence. I'm not intending to do an update of Fingerprints of the Gods. I think Fingerprints of the Gods is a document in its own right, which I'm glad to say people still find useful to refer to after nearly 20 years. And that book is there, and it's still in print, and I don't intend to change a word of that. But what I intend to do is to write a whole new book, reviewing new evidence that has come up, which reactivates and reawakens my curiosity in the possibilities I examined in Fingerprints of the Gods.
Graham, give some of our new listeners who haven't had an opportunity to read Fingerprints of the Gods a little highlight of what that was all about.
Right. Well, Fingerprints of the Gods, the subtitle is The Evidence of Earth's Lost Civilization. And what the book does is it looks at a whole range of mysteries and problems. It opens, for example, with a section on ancient maps, but there are these maps that have come down to us. Now, most of them were drawn in historical times. They were drawn in, say, 1500 or 1600 AD, 400 or 500 years ago. But when we look at the background to these maps, we find that the often famous map makers, such as Admiral Piri Reis or Mercator or Orontius Phineus, who made these maps, tell us that they based them on older source maps, which have not come down to us. And they often state that they had found these old maps in various archives, that the old maps were in a very fragile condition, worm-eaten, falling apart, literally crumbling away. And they decided to preserve the information on those maps by copying them onto new paper and creating basically a copy of an older source map. The older source map is now lost to us. And when we look at this category of maps, which include many maps from the so-called Portolan tradition and some from the Ptolemaic tradition, when we look at this category of maps, we find that it includes information which should not be there. Most strikingly and most intriguingly to me, the continent of Antarctica is shown on many of these maps. You can look at lots of maps from the 1500s and 1600s which show Antarctica in considerable detail. But the only error in it is that it seems to be much larger than Antarctica is today. But that turns out not to be an error, because here's the thing. Our civilization didn't discover Antarctica until the year 1818. So any appearance of Antarctica on a map before 1818 is deeply puzzling. And it doesn't. We really can't explain it in terms of orthodox history. And what these maps of Antarctica suggest is that our Earth was mapped by some seafaring civilization with a considerable degree of accuracy during the last ice age, when Antarctica was indeed much bigger than it is today, and when it looked exactly as it looks on those on those ancient maps. So this raises the hair-raising possibility that there was, at the time which we think of as the Upper Paleolithic, as the Stone Age, more than 12,000 years ago, going back to 20,000 years ago or more, when the Earth was plunged deep in the Ice Age, when sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today, when a huge swathe of North America was covered in a 2-mile-thick ice cap, and the same was true in Northern Europe, when the world looked very different, that somebody was mapping the world then and was doing it with a high degree of accuracy, and that somehow some of those maps survived through into historical times when they were copied by known map makers, and thus the information in them was passed down to us. So I have a whole section on these ancient maps, and what these ancient maps suggest to me is that there was a civilization capable, A, of exploring, and B, of mapping with good latitude and longitude references the whole planet deep in the Ice Age, perhaps as much as 20,000 years ago. And again, when I look at these maps, the accuracy is very good, but it is not the level of accuracy that you would display if you could cross interstellar space. It looks like human workmanship, but human workmanship of a standard that is far beyond anything that we would imagine from 20,000 years ago, when our ancestors are supposed all to have been primitive hunter-gatherers. And therefore, what it suggests to me is a forgotten episode in human history. And then from that section of the Fingerprints of the Gods, I went on to travel all around the world and to describe the myths and traditions of a global flood, that there was some kind of gigantic global cataclysm. And almost everywhere we encounter this tradition, the story of Atlantis is just one example of that tradition, but even the biblical flood of Noah mm-hmm. is another example of that tradition. Everywhere we encounter this tradition, there's a reference to a former golden age, to a higher level of civilization, which is brought to a sudden, a dramatic and devastating end by a global cataclysm. And it's often suggested that that civilization has fallen, has angered the gods, or has fallen out of harmony with the universe in some way, and this is why it's punished by the cataclysm. And then we get accounts of what read to me like survivors, of men and women who go around the world trying to, in a time of darkness, trying to reestablish civilization. And I look at those traditions, and I look at monuments that have come down from that time.
Graham, back to the ancient map makers for a moment. What kind yeah. of instrumentation do you think they had in order to do what they did?
Well, to do these maps, you would need, which document the world as it looked 20,000 years ago, you would need the level of technology that our civilization only began to master in the late 1700s and early 1800s. You would need 19th century level of technology. I'm not saying you would need 21st century level of technology, but you would need the ability to show not only accurate latitudes, which is a relatively straightforward thing to do, but also accurate longitudes. Now, I'm sorry, this is a little bit technical, but to sure. do longitude, you need accurate clocks. And the reason why, until the very late 1700s and early 1800s, the reason why our civilization could not do longitude. See, the problem of longitude was a gigantic problem for seafarers in the 1600s, 1700s, because they never knew how far east or west they were of a particular point. They couldn't tell accurately. That meant that they would have shipping disasters. They would crash into a coastline that they didn't expect to see. And there were huge prizes offered for anybody who could crack the problem of longitude. And what you need to crack the problem of longitude fundamentally is an accurate clock which will work at sea. It's not just that the clock should be accurate, it should be able to work perfectly at sea, and it should keep the time in your home port, and then you can work out how far east or west you are of a particular point. And it's just a fact of history that our civilization was not able to produce marine chronometers with that level of accuracy until the late 1700s or the early 1800s. And that's when we ourselves began to map the world accurately and began to be able to reproduce the level of accuracy that is shown in these maps from perhaps as much as 20,000 years ago, and I say 20,000 years ago because they show the world as we know it looked 20,000 years ago. And this is the mystery, and this is why I feel the best solution to that mystery is a lost human civilization, the kind of high civilization that is spoken of in many myths and traditions. But in order to make those maps, the level of technology they would have needed was the kind of technology we had in the early 18th century. It isn't a very, very high technology, but it's amazingly high technology for 20,000 years ago when we're supposed to have been primitive cavemen, you know.
Well, and you're right, too, because if it happened to have been ET technology gazing at us from above, the maps would have been pristine.
They'd have been pristine, and they'd have been absolutely perfect.
Yes.
In every degree. Instead, we get this amazing quality, which is far out of place in time, but is not absolutely perfect. And that's what I see, as I mentioned in the last segment, in the Great Pyramid as well, which has to stand out as perhaps the ultimate monument of the ancient world. Incredible precision, and yet it is not the level of precision that we would expect of beings who were capable of crossing interstellar space. You don't make little errors. You don't get your side lengths mismatching by as much as 7 inches. You don't fail to make your alignment perfect to true north. The Great Pyramid, as I mentioned, is just 3/60 of a single degree off true north. That's stunning accuracy when you're talking about a 6-million-ton monument with a 13-acre footprint that's 481 feet high. But it's still an error. And if you can navigate interstellar space to the point where you can go from one planet to another across interstellar space, you don't make even an error of 3/60 of a degree. You get it spot on. And that's why I think this is human workmanship that we're looking at here, but it's uncanny human workmanship. And it bears witness to the truth of the ancient myths all around the world that speak of a lost human civilization.
You know, when you came out with fingerprints and you came out with your theories of these ancient lost civilizations, did you run into any controversy with some of your scholars and peers?
Yes, absolutely. I was subjected to the most withering and vicious attacks. And I think anybody who works in the field of an alternative interpretation of the human condition will sooner or later find themselves under such attack if their work becomes prominent. You see, my great crime, as far as the mainstream academics were concerned, was not only that I presented an alternative view of history quite different from their own, but also that my book succeeded, that actually millions of people around the world bought and read and reacted to Fingerprints of the Gods. If Fingerprints of the Gods had simply vanished without a trace, if it had got, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 readers and there'd been no further interest, if it had gone out of print after a year or two, then there would have been no attacks on me. My great crime was that my book became prominent and popular. And for that reason, I had to be attacked because archaeology professors were getting questions from their students in class about why they were telling the story of ancient Egypt in one way, when here was Hancock, who was suggesting a totally alternative view of the history of ancient Egypt. And I'm proud to say that those questions are still being asked in university classes today, because Fingerprints has found a whole new generation of readers in the curious and open-minded youth who refuse to put up with the party line that has been fed to them by mainstream academia, and who are open to the possibility of mystery in the past. So yes, I was enormously attacked, and the attack started with academics themselves, and then they went on to their friends in the mainstream media and got them to attack me as well. And for a while, I did feel very persecuted. It was only later that I began to understand that this is the way academics work, that they actually also attack one another in this way. They are like a furious pack of attack dogs, actually, and the whole system of academia is based on destructive criticism. Confronted with a new idea, your first reaction as an academic is not to seek what may be worthy or valuable in that idea, but to seek to destroy that idea utterly and to destroy the individual who has presented that idea. And I suppose the reasoning is that if the idea can survive these violent and vicious attacks, which are often extremely underhand and use the techniques of propaganda in the way they're presented, if the idea can survive these attacks, then it may turn out to be the case that there is some merit in that idea. And that's, I'm pleased to say, what seems to have happened with Fingerprints of the Gods, because Fingerprints of the Gods has been continuously in print for close to 20 years now. It has survived those attacks. I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not even claiming that I'm right. I'm simply offering an alternative point of view, and that alternative point of view has some resonance, and it is beginning to be supported by whole swathes of new evidence that were not available in 1995 when I published the book. And this is what is interesting. This is what changes scientific ideas ultimately. It's new evidence that overwhelms the existing paradigm and makes the existing paradigm no longer acceptable. We begin to realize that we need a new reference frame. Just as for centuries it was believed that the sun revolved around the earth, it seemed to make perfect sense. You get up in the morning, you see the sun, and you see it rise through the sky descend on the other side of the sky. It looks like it revolves around the earth. And for centuries, that was the belief, that the sun revolved around the earth. And anybody who suggested that these observations were actually produced by the earth revolving around the sun were actually killed and burnt at the stake. But eventually, observations of the heavens, particularly with the introduction of telescopes and the ability to observe distant planets, eventually these observations overwhelmed that old bad idea, and we began to understand that the earth is not the center of everything, that the sun does not revolve around the earth, but rather that the earth and all the planets revolve around the sun. So it was new evidence that overwhelmed the old bad paradigm, and that's what I see beginning to happen now, 20 years after I published Fingerprints of the Gods, with the possibility of a lost civilization, that new evidence for a lost civilization is coming up, and it is going to make the old idea of history increasingly unacceptable to anybody with a reasonable mind.
Graham, thank God you weren't around during that era, because they would have stoned you for your beliefs.
Could be stoned to death, could be burnt at the stake. You see, the thing is, there's something about we humans, which is that in some weird way, we don't like change. We like the stability of the status quo. We like things the way they are. And a suggestion that the things the way they are is wrong can be deeply disturbing to huge quantities of people and seems to disturb. And it's not just at the level of ideas, it seems to fundamentally threaten their existence. And this explains the intense hostility of the academic reaction to an alternative idea of history, that if they've got it wrong all these years about history, then everything is wrong in their world. And that's such an upsetting idea that it produces this huge reaction and fight reaction on the part of academics, and all we can do is just persist. And I'm not alone. I have many amazing colleagues in this field: Randon Rose Flemath, Robert Boval, John Anthony West, Professor Robert Schock at Boston University, who is a mainstream academic but takes an alternative
Michael Cremo,
doing fantastic work on the deep antiquity of human technology. Many of us are working in this field, slowly working away and pursuing our own lines of inquiry, and those lines of inquiry are all converging on the possibility that we have indeed lost at least one and possibly several major episodes of the human story.
Graham, when we come back in a moment, I want to talk with you a little bit more about this catastrophic flood that, of course, was reported in Genesis as the flood of Noah. I want to get your take on that. A few more questions about the Ark of the Covenant. And, of course, then we'll get into some of the new evidence that's going to allow you to do the sequel, The Fingerprints of the Gods. And we'll go through each one of those forms of evidence. It's riveting. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment. Graham Hancock with us, right here on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Graham Hancock is with us here on Coast to Coast. We're going to be back with him as we talk more about his incredible work, Fingerprints of the Gods. And, of course, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Graham Hancock with us here. Graham, before we get into some of the incredible new evidence, which is leading you into the sequel, let's talk about the flood for a moment. Mm-hmm. What do you think the timeline was? I mean, assuming Atlantis was real and something sunk that island, that continent, whatever it might have been, might that have been the flood of Noah that they talk about in the Bible?
Yeah, I think all these references are to the same thing. We have to remember that the biblical a story of Noah has its antecedents in a Sumerian tradition called the Epic of Gilgamesh, which goes way back into remote prehistory. We have very similar traditions in India, particularly in southern India, of a gigantic flood that wiped out a former high civilization, a former golden age of mankind. Very similar traditions in Japan. These traditions are actually found all around the world, and what they draw our attention back to is an episode of global cataclysm that occurred somewhere around 13,000 years ago in our time frame. This is what all the myths and traditions seem to be focusing on, and many of them are quite specific in drawing our attention to that time. And this is very interesting for two reasons. Firstly, we know that the Earth went through dramatic changes between 20,000 years ago and 10,000 years ago. And, of course, 13,000 years ago is in exactly that window. And this was the meltdown of the last ice age. So 20,000 years ago, the last ice age is at its maximum extent. We have ice caps, mountains of ice sitting on top of North America and Northern Europe, 2 miles deep, completely covering areas that are today densely inhabited and highly productive. At that time, they were totally out of circulation. They were buried beneath 2 miles of ice. Exactly why that ice was there is still something that science has never fully explained, but we do know where the water came from that formed that ice. Sea level was 400 feet lower at that time than it is today. I mean, that is a staggering change in sea level that took place when all that ice melted and all that water went back into the sea. The sea level went up by 400 feet, and that meant that 10 million square miles of land that were above water 20,000 years ago are underwater today. And that's why I spent 6 years of my research career diving, scuba diving all over the world, looking at those submerged continental shelves. So huge features like the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf, were completely dry. There was no sea in them 20,000 years ago. Southeast Asia was gigantically extended. Australia was joined to New Guinea. Sri Lanka was joined to India. There were huge islands off the east coast of North America in the area where we have the Grand Bahama Banks today. There were vast islands there. Easter Island in the Pacific Ocean was part of a huge archipelago of exposed seamounts, which are today underwater, leaving only a tiny fraction of land left that we call Easter Island today. So the whole world was very, very different. Sea level rose by 400 feet over those 10,000 years, and during that 10,000-year period of the meltdown of the last ice age, there were a number of very significant episodes of melting, a very radical, very sudden melting. And one of those episodes was initiated around 12,980 years ago, close to 13,000 years ago. We can be very precise about that. And until recently, we didn't know what had caused it. When I wrote Fingerprints of the Gods, I didn't know what had caused that episode of melting around 13,000 years ago. I just knew that it had happened, that it had been very radical, that at that point the Earth was coming out of the ice age, and then it suddenly went back into a 1,000-year deep freeze, which geologists call the Younger Dryas. And during that 1,000-year deep freeze, there were huge extinctions of large animal species, such as the mammoths, for example. Mm-hmm. We didn't know what caused it. And one of the reasons why I'm writing a sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods is that we now have a smoking gun. We now have very clear evidence of what it was that caused that massive episode of flooding 12,980 years ago, and why it was then followed by a 1,000-year return to freezing conditions. And the answer to this is that the Earth was hit by a comet, and it was hit particularly badly in North America. This was a fragmenting comet, a comet that was torn into multiple fragments, rather like Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Comet or asteroid? Do you believe comet. It was a comet? Okay.
Comet. The signature in the Greenland ice cores, a layer of platinum, quite clearly indicates that we were hit by a comet. There are microspherules all around the world, which are, again, are the classic signature of a comet impact. And so there's really no doubt in science that this was a comet. The evidence first began to be explored by people like Firestone back in 2007. It was subject to controversy for some years. Further testing was done, further evidence and investigation was undertaken, most recently from the Greenland ice cores, and it's now absolutely clear, I don't think anybody's seriously arguing about this anymore, 12,980 years ago, we can be that precise, give or take 5 years, North America was massively impacted by the fragments of a giant comet. And not only North America, but other parts of the world as well, the impact was worst in North America. This explosive impact on North America caused a huge dust cloud to be thrown up into the upper atmosphere. That dust cloud enveloped the Earth for 1,000 years, reflecting back the sun's rays into space and caused the mysterious deep freeze that geologists have called the Younger Dryas. Now, one of the arguments against it being a comet was the apparent absence of impact craters, but there's an amazing researcher called Randall Carlson, who I'm working closely with and who I'm going to be doing a research journey with in the Pacific Northwest next year. And Randall Carlson's suggestion, really important suggestion, which he's been making for some years, far ahead of his time, is that the reason we don't see the impact crater is because the biggest fragments of the comet actually hit the North American ice cap. They hit that, by then, mile and a half deep ice cap. They pulverized it. They turned it instantly into water, creating these gigantic floods that poured down off the ice cap, carrying huge boulders and strewing them all over the landscape of the Pacific.
Tsunami, Graham. The tsunami must have been huge.
And a tsunami, absolutely, because that you don't only have the flood off the ice cap, but you also have fragments going into the ocean. So we cannot envisage today a cataclysm on this scale. This was a gigantic cataclysm that hit the Earth 12,980 years ago. And what I'm suggesting, what I'm saying strongly, is this is the smoking gun. We did not just lose mammoths. We did not just lose what is called the Clovis culture, the Stone Age culture of North America. We lost a whole civilization at that time, which was almost completely rubbed from the record, and which is remembered only in myths and traditions. And the effort now is to recover the evidence for that lost civilization. And really, the evidence of this comet is absolutely stunning. And it reminds us of two things. Firstly, that these things do happen again and again in Earth's history, and that they are quite large enough to wipe out a whole civilization, including our own. And secondly, when you deal with comets, which are things that sometimes have orbits of 12, 13,000 years, it's possible that fragments of that comet that hit us 12,980 years ago are still in orbit. It's possible they could still come back. They may even be, and again, Randall Carlson's work strongly suggests this, that they may even be wrapped up in what we call the torrid meteor shower. That we may have some huge blocks of icy rock sitting in that mass of fragments orbiting through outer space, and we may not yet be entirely safe from them.
Just a dramatic episode, but there must have been some survivors, Graham, to carry on the message, right?
That's absolutely my view, that there were survivors. They may have felt that their civilization had done something terribly wrong. They may have felt that they were being punished by the gods. They may have felt that they had taken a wrong course in their direction. And there's much in ancient myths and traditions that suggest this. But we have these accounts, whether it's the people called the Viracochas in South America, in the Andes, whether it's Quetzalcoatl in Central America, whether it's Manu in India, whether it's Osiris in Egypt, we have these accounts of civilizers who settle amongst the devastated remnants of mankind and seek to reignite the spark of civilization. And what I've been looking at in the last months is some sites around the world of which one of the most intriguing, there are actually several, but one of the most intriguing is Göbekli Tepe in Turkey.
Yes.
A giant series of megalithic circles on the scale of Stonehenge. Now, you see, Stonehenge is just 5,000 years old, according to mainstream archaeology. So to get a series of gigantic megalithic circles, which are now proved to be 12,000-plus years old, which is the case in Göbekli Tepe, that on its own completely rewrites history. There is no place, there is no space in the existing model of history for something like Göbekli Tepe. Our ancestors at 12,000 years ago are not supposed to have had the organizational ability to create a gigantic series of stone circles, but that's what we find at Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey. And I recently spent a week down there, and I spent a lot of time talking to the mainstream archaeologist who's excavating that site, and the evidence is absolutely stunning. I think in Göbekli Tepe, we're looking at the fingerprints of the survivors of a lost civilization. It was their project to attempt to restart civilization.
Now, Tepe, in terms of how it looks, it's all stone structure, obviously. How big is it, Graham?
Well, I think anybody, almost everybody who's listening will have a picture in their mind of Stonehenge in Britain. It's like 50 times bigger than Stonehenge. At the moment, only a fraction of it has been excavated. Only four stone circles have been excavated. But under the ground, Klaus Schmidt, the archaeologist from the German Archaeological Institute who discovered the site and who has been exploring it for the last 8 or 9 years, has run ground-penetrating radar over the site. And when I interviewed him a few weeks ago in Turkey, he told me that the ground-penetrating radar reveals that at least 20 times as many stone circles are still under the ground, and possibly as many as 50 times as many as they have presently excavated. So this puts it on a scale way beyond Stonehenge. And you are looking at blocks of stone that in pillars of stone that in some cases weigh as much as 50 tons. I went and examined one in the quarry, which they had not completely removed from the quarry because they discovered a fault in it. And that one is a full-scale 50-ton pillar. And to have the ability to move 50-ton blocks of stone more than 12,000 years ago is something that cannot be explained by mainstream history. Now, let me outline for you why we know that Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years old, because there's a mystery in that as well.
Tell me why you think it was built. What did they use it for?
I will, absolutely. Okay. First of all, the evidence for its age. Most megalithic sites, if we look at the megalithic temples of Malta, for example, or indeed Stonehenge itself, have been exposed to the elements for thousands and thousands of years, and many later cultures have wandered over them and perhaps even moved the stones around to some extent and contaminated the sites with more recent carbon. You see, you can't carbon date stone. Stone is very difficult to date.
That's correct.
You can only date organic material associated with the stone, and then you then make the assumption that the stone structure dates from the same material as the organic material, the bone or the charcoal that you've dug up. But that is an assumption, not an absolute fact. Why it's pristine and perfect in Göbekli Tepe is that Göbekli Tepe, whoever mysteriously built it more than 12,000 years ago, used it for 2,000 years and then deliberately buried it like a time capsule. It was covered up with infill. It's not slow sedimentation. It's deliberate human infill that covered up this site, completely covered the stone circles, and actually covered it with a hill. And that's what Göbekli Tepe means in the Turkish language. It means pot-bellied hill. And that's what it looked like. It looked like a pot-bellied hill. And for 10,000 years, nobody ever went there or investigated it. It's only in the late 1990s, when Klaus Schmidt begins his excavations, that we discover that underneath this pot-bellied hill is this gigantic complex of stone circles at a very high level of execution, with beautiful relief carvings on them, and with huge megaliths moved into place. High levels of organizational skill would be required to put that into place, and because it was deliberately buried 10,000 years ago, having been started more than 12,000 years ago, we can be quite sure of its antiquity. There's been no later contamination by other cultures. And it raises the question that maybe megalithic sites all over the world are much older than we think they are. Maybe the whole megalithic enterprise has been misdated and misunderstood. Göbekli Tepe raises this question again and again in multiple ways about other megalithic sites. So there's the first thing, and it's a mystery itself. Why did they bury it? And were they actually trying to send down a time capsule to the future to say, look what we could do more than 12,000 years ago in your calendar? Look what we could do. We could do this. And it so happens that it's in our time that Göbekli Tepe has been discovered and has been excavated. And secondly, you asked what was it done for? It's really intriguing. If you look at that area of southeastern Turkey, it is in the archaeological record an amazing center of innovation. All kinds of things that we regard as fundamental to civilization seem to begin there. They seem to take root there, including agriculture. This is the place that in our epoch of history, this is where agriculture seems to have begun. And what I'm suggesting is that Göbekli Tepe was a creation of the survivors of a lost civilization, and they put their architectural skills to work to create this huge series of stone circles. Very likely it had some religious purpose for them as well, and they also taught the local inhabitants the rudiments of agriculture, which then became the agricultural revolution and the Neolithic as it enters into the mainstream historical picture. So it's just an extraordinary center of innovation in architecture, of innovation in agriculture, and there's no explanation yet from mainstream history as to how that was done. I think the answer is that survivors of a lost civilization brought those skills to Göbekli Tepe and created it deliberately as a center of innovation, because it's a huge mystery. This thing just comes out of nowhere. I mean, you don't, as a hunter-gatherer, wake up one morning and decide to make 50-ton megaliths, hundreds of them, and to organize them into huge stone circles. There's no precedent for that anywhere in the archaeological record. There has to be a background to Göbekli Tepe, and I suggest that background is a lost civilization.
What kind of equipment might they have had, Graham, in order to do this construction?
Well, nothing has survived in terms of the tools that were used. This is the other mystery. The cutting of the rock is extremely precise and extremely fine. These pillars are perfectly executed. They look like they've been cut with metal tools, but there are not supposed to have been any metal tools in that period. I mean, this is thousands of years before the beginning even of the Copper Age, and yet we see these very precisely cut, polished megaliths and polished and cut bedrock. The bedrock has been worked to an extraordinary degree as well. So it's a real mystery what they actually used to cut these tools. The assumption of mainstream archaeology is that they used primitive stone tools, because primitive stone tools are the only tools that people of that time are supposed to have. But the appearance of Göbekli Tepe completely belies that assumption and suggests again that we are looking at hard evidence of a lost technology, a technology that has no place in the existing scheme of history, but would make sense if we consider the possibility of a lost civilization.
Well, that's evidence number one.
That's evidence number one.
Lost civilization. What about other regions on the planet?
Well, there is an incredible site, and again, this is rewriting history, that I'm going to be visiting in the first 2 weeks of December in Indonesia. And this site is called Gunung Padang. And again, it is a megalithic site on a giant scale. And again, a pot-bellied hill enclosed it. And the first
same
kind of thing. It looks very like Göbekli Tepe. And the first discovery of it was actually quite a long time ago, in 1914. That's when Gunung Padang was first recognized as an ancient site. And it was thought then to be 3,000 or 4,000 years old. But now we have a new survey done by a leading PhD geologist, an Australian geologist who's working for the Indonesian government, and he has revealed that the site is as much as 20,000 years old, that
wow,
it's been completely misdated, and that it is going to utterly rewrite history.
Let's talk more about that, Graham, when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Graham Hancock with us. Graham, let's get into Indonesia now. So there is a similar structure there like Göbekli Tepe?
Well, it's a megalithic site made with basalt blocks which take a natural hexagonal form, and of which have been built up into this huge multi-layered pyramid that at one time was completely covered with earth, and it's called Gunung Padang. And when the first level of it was revealed in the early 20th century, it was thought to be 3,000 or 4,000 years old, which is quite old, but it doesn't threaten the mainstream view of history. It fits into the mainstream view of history. You can have a megalithic site in Indonesia that's 4,000 years old. The problem is that a PhD geologist called Danny Hillman, he's Australian, and he's been working for the government of West Java on a detailed site survey of Gunung Padang for the last 5 years, has just released his findings, he and his team, and I'm going to be going out to Indonesia and meeting them, and also going out at that time is Robert Schock, the geologist from Boston University, who was responsible for the radical redating of the Great Sphinx of Giza. Schock and I will be together in Indonesia looking at Gunung Padang, and Gunung Padang is absolutely stunning in its implications, because first of all, the research has been done by a mainstream geologist, by Danny Hillman, PhD, who brings scientific rigor to his investigation. This is a mainstream guy, and what he's discovered from excavating the entire site, going down to the deepest layers, finding huge megalithic structures that have previously been covered, is that this site actually ranges between 9,000 and 20,000 years of age. And to have a megalithic site on this scale that is 20,000 years old is something that mainstream history simply cannot explain. And he's already said he's sorry. He realizes that this is going to cause a huge hostile reaction from archaeology, but the facts are the facts. He is simply presenting the data, and the data is that Gunung Padang is 20,000 years old. And therefore, by definition, we are looking at the work, at the fingerprints, at the remnants of a lost civilization in Indonesia. And we have to remember that during the Ice Age, the whole picture of Indonesia and Southeast Asia was very, very different than it is today. This is an area that geologists call the Sunda Shelf. And instead of having the narrow Malaysian peninsula and the islands of Indonesia, we had a vast extended tongue of Southeast Asia that plunged plunged down thousands of miles further than it does today. So Indonesia then was part of a huge exposed Ice Age continent, which was most of which was very rapidly submerged at the end of the last Ice Age. And what we may be looking at here is a structure that was built in an area that was never submerged. But let's imagine how many structures there are underwater off the Sunda Shelf. So it's raising huge questions, and it raises questions over another site, one that I've explored already, which is called Nan Madol in Micronesia on the island of Ponape. There we have a site that is built of exactly the same basalt type of blocks that we see at Gunung Padang, which archaeology has traditionally dated to just 800 or 900 years old. But when I went diving off Ponape, off Nan Madol in Micronesia, I went down to 120 feet beneath the sea, and I found that these structures continued underwater all the way to the seabed, 120 feet beneath sea level. And when you find structures and huge pillars, as we found there, 120 feet beneath sea level, then you are facing absolute evidence that they've been underwater for more than 12,000 years, because that was the last time that that area, 120 feet beneath sea level, was above water, was 12,000 plus years ago. So it again goes exactly into that window of the comet-induced global cataclysm 12,980 years ago. So all in all around the world, I see the fingerprints of a lost civilization emerging, continuing to emerge, and continuing to confound and confront the picture of history that has been stuffed down our throats for so many years by mainstream archaeology.
So let's paint a picture for us, Graham. Pre-comet, 12,900 years ago, before the comet hits, kind of describe what the civilizations are like, what life is like on good old planet Earth.
Well, just as we today on planet Earth have a high technological civilization that coexists with Stone Age hunter-gatherer civilizations. We have Stone Age hunter-gatherer civilizations in the Kalahari Desert. We have them in the jungles of Africa. We have them in the Amazon jungle. We have them in some parts of Indonesia and New Guinea. Stone Age civilizations, some of which have not even made contact with our civilization yet, and they coexist on the planet with our high technological civilization. So I make that point to say that it's possible on Earth to have different levels of civilization coexisting at the same time. And we know it's possible because we have that now. And what I'm suggesting is that before the comet impact, before 12,980 years ago, that was the picture on Earth then as well. There was a high civilization, globally distributed, occupying mainly the maritime, the coastal belts, which were the best areas of land at that time, navigating the world, exploring the world, mapping the world, with at least an early 19th century level of technology, and in some ways perhaps far beyond, because we should remember that our form of technology is not the only technology. Much in the ancient myths and traditions suggest that the lost civilization was in command of other forms of technology, what we might call psychic technology today, energizing the powers of the human mind in a way that we do not do. Maybe there are direct telekinetic and telepathic powers that we human beings have, which have fallen, which have lapsed as we have explored the technological route, but maybe a lost civilization had mastered those powers in ways that we don't yet fully understand. So we have a civilization that's capable of exploring and mapping the world and building huge, highly accurate stone structures. And we also have existing in the world at that time Stone Age civilizations, Stone Age cultures, which, for example, painted caves and left behind Stone Age arrowheads and so on and so forth. Both levels of civilization existed on Earth then, just as both levels of civilization existed now. And when the cataclysm came 12,980 years ago, what it wiped out was the higher level of civilization. Those lower levels of culture, those Stone Age cultures, were resilient enough with their basic skills to survive the cataclysm. And just as we discussed at the beginning, our civilization, our technological civilization, is very fragile. Because we specialize so much, a global cataclysm would wipe our civilization out overnight. But Stone Age peoples like the Bushmen of the Kalahari would continue to survive because they have the survival skills. And that's the suggestion about what happened at the end of the last ice age as well. And lastly, that there were some survivors who maintained some of the wisdom and some of the technology of the lost civilization, and they settled amongst Stone Age peoples in Turkey, in Indonesia, in South America too, because that's another area I've just come back from, is Peru and Bolivia, and they are remembered as the civilizing heroes. In South America, they were called the Viracochas. They're described as white-skinned and bearded, and they brought a higher level of technology to those Stone Age cultures at that time and left certain mementos and remnants in the rock.
Graham, there seems to be some evidence of a past nuclear war among those Earthlings on this planet. Have you uncovered anything like that?
I have a group of colleagues from Italy who went over the site of Mohenjo-Daro in the Indus Valley in Pakistan with Geiger counters. And Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa, which I've also visited myself several times, by the way, are often described as having been irradiated by nuclear weapons of some kind. Certainly there are descriptions of what sound like nuclear weapons in the ancient Indian texts, but the Italian team were not able to find any evidence of radiation there with their Geiger counters. Maybe it was some radiation that doesn't show up on a Geiger counter, but they certainly were not able to find that evidence. I withhold judgment on that. I think we need to look further before we leap to those conclusions.
So as we move on into where we are today, what do you think this planet looked like after the catastrophe, and how many people do you think might have been around?
Utterly, utterly devastated, a huge loss and narrowing down of human populations. You've got to remember, this wasn't just an overnight cataclysm caused by the comet. This was 1,000 years of pain. This was 1,000 years of dark skies, and it's often spoken of as a time of darkness in the ancient myths. 1,000 years of dark skies, 1,000 years of deep freeze, the episode that geologists call the Younger Dryas, because the comet throws up huge quantities of dust into the upper atmosphere, and that dust shuts off the sun's rays from reaching the Earth, you get a very little sunlight coming through. And effectively, it's what we would describe today, talking about nuclear. If we were to have a nuclear war, a global nuclear war, it would have a similar effect to that comet. It would throw up huge amounts of dust into the upper atmosphere, shut out the sun's rays, and we would be plunged into a sudden deep freeze. Comets have done that in the past. A comet did it 12,980 years ago. 1,000 years of pain followed. And after that 1,000 years, the dust cloud gradually dissipated, and the Earth went back into a warming episode again. And we enter the period that is broadly understood by mainstream history and archaeology.
Interesting when they talk about 1,000 years, it almost echoes the Book of Revelation, doesn't it?
Yes, I mean the cataclysmic, apocalyptic descriptions in the Book of Revelations bear some thought. And I don't want to be a prophet of doom. I think it's really important to think positively. I don't like speaking of coming doom and disaster. This is something that we have too much of a tendency to do in the modern world, and I believe there's a danger that we can manifest that disaster by almost wishing it upon ourselves. I think it's good to think positively, and I think it's good to behave positively, and I think it's good to recognize that perhaps the greatest danger to the human race is the human race itself, and our own mad, unconscious, greedy, selfish, cruel, suspicious behavior. We need to evolve to a higher level, and we need to do that urgently as a species if we are going to have a future. And the fundamental thing is love for one another. We have to learn to practice love and not to behave in a selfish and greedy and suspicious and hateful way. And part of it also is thinking positively, envisaging a positive future for ourselves rather than envisaging a negative future. But the truth of the matter is life on this planet is very fragile. We can take nothing for granted. We have to work for our survival. And part of that working for our survival is moving on from the old model that we've been stuck with for so long, where we're divided into nations and separate from one another, and each of us feels that we are special and that other human beings are somehow inferior to ourselves. We need to recognize that we are all one, that we are all one people, we are all brothers and sisters, and we need to exercise the power of love, not just within the nation we happen to have been born in, but within the world as a whole. And when I talk about the world as a whole, the last thing I'm talking about is a one-world government. Let no one misunderstand me on that. I hate governments. I hate governments of all kinds, yeah. And I definitely don't want a one-world government. As a matter of fact, I don't want any government at all. I want us as human beings to take responsibility for ourselves and move on to the next level of maturity as responsible, sovereign adults, where we look after one another as members of the human race without these overarching structures that have ruled us and misguided us for so long, called governments and states and corporations.
We need about 6 billion more humans like you, Graham. Maybe we can get it done then, huh?
We can get it done. I have great optimism for the future of the human race. I believe that we are incredibly blessed species to have this planet, to have the human experience on. We're incredibly fortunate, and we just need to take our good fortune in our hands, realize this precious jewel of a planet that the universe has given to us, and live up to what is expected of us. You know, we have this amazing brain power, this amazing ability to do wonderful things, and the amazing capacity for love. Yes, there is hatred. Yes, there is cruelty in the world, but matching it everywhere is love and decency and goodness. And I think human beings are fundamentally good. And if we weren't misguided by our governments, which have vested interests in division and hatred and suspicion and fear, if we weren't misguided by the big corporations that seek to exploit us for short-term economic gain, if we weren't misguided by the big mainstream religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, all claiming to have a monopoly on the truth, if we were able to explore our own innate capacity for spirituality, taking responsibility for it ourselves rather than being told what to do by priests and rabbis and mullahs, that's the future I see for us, that we move on into a bright new world.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. And an interesting twist to your career, tell me about the novel War God.
Well, this is an area where I hope that my readers will support me. I am writing fiction as well as nonfiction, and I've just published in America War God, which is a novel about the Spanish conquest of Mexico, which was an incredible episode in the human story when 490 ruthless Spaniards took on 200,000 even more ruthless Aztecs and actually defeated them.
And, how did they do that?
It was done. We'll need a little bit of the next segment to discuss this.
Yes, story. We're going to have
it's
to.
It's quite a big story.
Unbelievable.
But it was one of those incredible events in human history. And actually, Hernan Cortes, the conquistador, was able to exploit the myth of Quetzalcoatl, of the return of the white-skinned, bearded civilizer. He actually arrived on the coast of Mexico in February 1519, and that was exactly the moment when Quetzalcoatl, the so-called god of peace, was expected to return according to ancient Mexican prophecy. And really remarkable events unfolded then. Just extraordinary things happened. And if I could take this opportunity to say, I'd like to make an offer to Coast to Coast listeners who
Please.
Buy the American paperback or Kindle edition of my book. If you go to my website, grahamhancock.com, and click on the War God page, which is very clear, and go to the links there, write to me at the email address I give there. I guarantee you I'll give you a personal reply, and I will send you a signed, dedicated book plate, which is a label to paste inside your copy of the book. And this is my return gift to those
Beautiful.
Who support my fledgling career as a fiction writer, because publishers don't want me to write fiction. They want me to stick to nonfiction.
Well, this may be a movie in Hollywood. You never know, Graham.
Well, it was an amazing episode of human history, and I hope we'll have a chance to talk a little
we'll
bit.
We'll talk about that in our next segment. We'll take some phone calls. We'll talk about the possibility again, too, if you think mankind went to the moon in the ancient days. I wonder if our current astronauts, for example, saw remnants of a past civilization. And do you think that's possible? Do you think they did?
I do think that's possible. I do think that's possible. There has not only on the moon but also on the planet Mars, there have been such there is such intriguing and tantalizing evidence that may be being covered up for us. What I find again and again is that the powers that be, the existing powers, the powers that control our world today, seek to keep us in darkness. There is a focused and concentrated effort to keep humanity asleep, to prevent us from recognizing our true heritage, where we came from and what we really are and what we're really capable of. And sadly, this is being done in pursuit of short-term profit and the power-mad nature of the individuals who presently run our societies. They cannot enjoy power if we become fully enfranchised and free and responsible and sovereign adults. And to be fully enfranchised and free and responsible and sovereign adults, we need to understand the truth about our own past. We cannot understand our present predicament if we don't understand the truth about our own past. And that's why I've long felt that history and archaeology are part of a rather sinister system of mind control that operates in our society today and that serves the interests of tiny elite minorities who've controlled
us
for far too long.
So true. We're going to come back more in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we're talking with Graham Hancock about his unbelievable theory of a incredible catastrophe that hit the planet 12,900 years ago, a comet. And when we come right back, we're going to talk about his latest work, War God, and we'll take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Graham Hancock with us. Graham, let's get into War God if we can. So the Aztecs have 200,000 warriors. Cortez has 490 men. How does he conquer them?
It's the most extraordinary thing, and this is why I decided to write this as a novel, because the facts are so incredible that you just couldn't make them up. these 200,000 Aztecs, this is a cruel and brutal culture. I don't seek to whitewash the reputation of the Aztecs in any way. Their culture revolved around human sacrifice. They cut out their victims' hearts on the top of the Great Pyramid in Tenochtitlan, which is on the site of modern Mexico City. When that pyramid was inaugurated, 80,000 people were sacrificed in this brutal way, and the streets of the city ran knee-deep in blood, and the whole pyramid was covered in blood. They were a superstitious people. They believed that they were guided and led by a god of war whose name was Huitzilopochtli, which means hummingbird. And it was the contacts in trance states that Moctezuma had with this god of war that led him on to incredible acts of cruelty and wickedness. Now, the Spanish, on the other side of the story, were also a cruel people and an incredibly militarily focused people. They just completed 700 years of the reconquest of Spain from the Moors, and the concept of holy war was very central in their world. And what interests me about this story is that both sides are bad. It's a story about the battle of good against evil, but the good in my story is the ordinary human beings who were caught up in this incredible conflict. Women like Malinal, who became the mistress of Cortez, who used Cortez as her instrument to bring down the empire of terror headed by Moctezuma. Now, why was Cortez, with 490 men, able to defeat 200,000 Aztecs, who, if they caught a Spaniard, would cut out his heart? And the answer to that is quite a number of different things. First and foremost, military technology. The Aztecs were a Stone Age people. They didn't have metal weapons. The Spanish had swords of Toledo steel, the finest steel in the world at that time. They had guns, very primitive muskets called the arquebus. They had about 100 men who were armed with these primitive muskets. They had a few cannon, little cannon called falconets and larger cannon called lombards, which could fire, as well as cannonballs, could fire grapeshot. And grapeshot is a devastating thing to fire into a massed enemy charging down on you. It could kill 300-400 men at a time and discharging these huge clouds of sulfurous smoke at the same time. The Spanish also had dogs, which were trained to relish human flesh, war dogs, mastiffs, wolfhounds. Now, the Aztecs had dogs as well. They had chihuahuas. So they had no idea what they were dealing with when they confronted these Spanish dogs of war. And the Spanish war dogs were armored in steel plate and in mail, so that even if an Aztec warrior tried to stab a dog with his stone weapon, it would be turned by the armor worn by the dog. And they thought these dogs were dragons. But last but not least, the Spanish had cavalry. They had only 16 heavy horse. But cavalry had never been used in the New World before. Cortez's cavalry charges were the first use of cavalry in the New World. The horse had been extinct in the New World for more than 12,000 years. And the devastating impact of these cavalry charges, the firm military discipline of the Spaniards, and the fear of the Aztecs that these cavalry were some kind of supernatural being, part horse, part man. You have to remember that the cavalry are armored in steel. They are bearing down on the massed Aztec forces at 30 miles an hour. The ground is trembling beneath their feet. And it caused panic and chaos in the Aztec ranks. And the shock of a cavalry charge would again and again completely turn a battle. And all of this in a supernatural context. This was the amazing mystery of the Spanish conquest of Mexico, that Cortez arrived on the Gulf of Mexico coast at exactly the moment when Aztec prophecy said that a god called Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, who had been driven out in the distant past but who had promised to return and overthrow a wicked king, Cortez arrived at exactly the moment that that prophecy said somebody of his description would arrive, a white-skinned, bearded man. And he was first taken to be a god, armored in metal, using mysterious weapons that could dismember men at a distance. All of this was contained in the prophecy, and Cortez fulfilled the prophecy. And the central character of my novel, Malinal, a woman who's a true historical character, conveys to Cortez how he can use this prophecy, this myth, to overthrow Moctezuma, to undermine Moctezuma psychologically, to dominate him mentally before he ever meets him on the battlefield. So it was a combination of all of these factors that allowed this tiny Spanish force to carry a victory against the against the Aztecs. But the idea I'm playing with in this novel is that supernatural forces were at work. And that's one of the reasons I wrote it as a novel. So the Aztec god of war, Hummingbird, is a character in the novel. And it's a historical fact that Cortez felt himself to be guided by St. Peter. And the idea I'm playing with is that the same demonic entity that appears to Moctezuma as the war god takes on another disguise and appears to Cortez in the disguise of St. Peter and manipulates and plays both these men to multiply human misery. And indeed, the Spanish conquest of Mexico is a key factor in the world we live in today. The whole genocide that followed of Native American Indians in North America, I don't believe would ever have taken place if the Spanish hadn't won that victory against the Aztecs in Mexico. The conquest of Peru that followed soon afterwards would not have taken place. The whole relationship of the Western countries to indigenous peoples would have been different if things had gone differently in Mexico. So it was a turning point in human history, and we still live with its consequences today. And I've tried to encapsulate all of this in the story of War God.
What an amazing history, Graham. Absolutely riveting. The things that went on in this planet a long time ago, huh?
And at the same time, the power of human love and courage and decency in the darkest of times to thrive and come through and show that there is some fundamental quality in we human beings that is worthy of preservation. At any rate, if listeners are interested, please go to my website, look at the War God page. I've got a special offer on the U.S. edition of the book, which is that you have to buy the book from Amazon.com, either as a paperback or as an ebook. There's already 128 reader reviews there, so you can get an idea of how readers are reacting to the book. Buy the book through the links on my website from Amazon.com, either as an ebook or as a paperback book. Write to me at wargoddedications@gmail.com. That email address is on my website. I will email you back personally within the next 2 weeks, and I will send you at my own expense a signed label with the dedication of your choice to place inside your copy of the book.
Let's take some calls, and I want to talk with you later about some structures on the moon, Graham, that some people have reported. We'll go to Timmy in Jacksonville, Florida, east of the Rockies. You're on with Graham Hancock. Go ahead, Timmy.
Hey, George and Graham. Great show.
Hi,
man.
Thank you.
You know, I have a statement, and I just would like you to kind of, if you would, comment on it. But, you know, I feel like we've been kind of sold a bill of sale, bill of goods, and, you know, it's kind of foolish. I don't think man was banging his head on a rock trying to figure out how to do stuff. You know, I think man was designed, not just spiritual and physical, but an amazing thing that, you know, looked around and observed. We're like a bunch of lemmings right now. We listen to what we're told. And, you know, of course, order is good, but order by disorder or by falsehood is kind of silly, you know?
I completely agree with you. We live in a deluded world. Our governments seek to persuade us that they create order and that they provide us with security. The opposite is true. The behavior of our governments causes disorder and makes us deeply insecure, and indeed is designed to make us insecure. This is part of the demonic warfare against mankind that's been going on for centuries, was present in the Spanish conquest of Mexico, has been present in deep prehistory, and is present today, an attempt to deny us our own sovereign right as adults to make choices about the direction of our own lives. So the fear button is what is pressed by governments, the button of fear and hatred and suspicion to narrow us down and make us constantly afraid. And that's why governments actually, by their behavior, seek to make us more insecure while pretending that they're making us more secure. It's the biggest con trick in history. And what I see happening now is an awakening all around the world and a recognition that we, the people, will not put up with this misleading of us any longer by our governments, by the big corporations, by the big religions. Time has come for us to take sovereign control of our own destiny.
Graham, I wanted to ask you, too, it seems that Jesus comes well after the calamity that occurred 12,900 years ago.
Yes.
Interesting timing, I would think.
Well, the, the figure of Jesus is a really fascinating figure. We have to remember that Christianity, as we have it today, is a kind of edited construct. That a particular there were many different factions of early Christianity. If you go back 2,000 years ago, if you go back to 200, 300, 400 after Christ, there were many different types of Christians, and one particular type of Christian that became the Roman Catholic Church, that pulled on the jackboot of the Roman state, that became a dominator force, has edited the documents that we get from Christianity. And it's well understood if you look at the behavior of the mainstream church over the years. You see, for example, what did the Roman Catholic Church used to burn people at the stake, and not only Roman Catholics, Protestants as well, used to burn people at the stake for any slight divergence from the Orthodox doctrine. I challenge you to find anywhere in the words of Jesus Christ the instruction that we should burn one another at the stake. Jesus Christ was a teacher of peace. He was a bringer of enlightenment, and his mission has been hijacked by the huge corporation that is called the church today. And actually, I think what we need to do with these organized churches is not listen to what they say, but to look at what they do. And what they've done down the ages is divide people, torture people, literally burn people at the stake. And that is not found in the teachings of Christ. Christ is much more related to an early faction of Christianity that was called Gnosticism, which was later stamped out by the Roman Catholic Church. And what we have to do is just look at actually the mission of Christ, which is a mission of enlightenment, a mission of revelation, and a mission of peace. And we understand that he is being misrepresented to us by the church.
Okay, back to the phones we go. We'll go to Key in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Key, go ahead.
Hi. I have a couple questions. The main one is when you were talking about the theory of psychic technology and then not finding radiation when areas were tested for war, I'm wondering if we need to find or try to discover the ways and symptoms of frequency warfare, and that maybe in those areas that we feel might have had war might represent or have a different frequency?
Very interesting point that you're making there, and I think a very important point, which is that if we keep looking at the mysteries of the past through the particular lens of our culture and our technology today, and we look for evidence of our kind of technology in the past, we may miss the bigger picture, which is that in the remote past there may have been civilizations that deployed completely different technologies which we haven't even discovered or dreamt of today. And the idea of frequency weapons is a very interesting one in that respect, and would not leave a radiation footprint, but nevertheless would cause massive devastation. So I think we have to open our minds to the possibility that totally different forms of technology were deployed in the past. We've gone down one particular route, but there are many other routes of technology. And I often, as I said earlier, feel that the latent faculties of the human mind, which have fallen into neglect in our society, faculties like psi, like telekinesis, like telepathy, for which there is quite a lot of documentation, but which mainstream science laughs at today. Such faculties may have been developed to a very high level in remote antiquity. And again, they would not leave a technological footprint because they don't require machinery to operate. They are operated directly by the powers of the human mind.
Graham, there have been some who claim that there are glass structures on the moon. If we had high technology, and as we talked about earlier,
well, I think we have to pay tribute here to the fantastic work over the years, the dedicated work against huge opposition of Richard Hoagland, who has helped us again and again to understand that all is not as it seems in the story that NASA has given to us, whether that story is given on the moon or whether it's given on the planet Mars. And I've known Richard Hoagland for many years, and he's a dedicated, brilliant researcher who's done fantastic work in opening the public's mind and who's faced tremendous opposition, just as I've faced opposition from archaeologists. Richard has faced huge opposition and real attacks on himself from the NASA establishment. I think he's even put himself in real physical jeopardy and danger to bring us this alternative point of view, which is that it seems that structures were found on the moon, that there are structures on the planet Mars, and that NASA is covering this up. And this cover-up is all part of keeping us from the truth about ourselves and our condition, the human condition within the solar system as a whole. The Earth does not exist alone. It is part of the solar system, part of the universe. And just as we are kept in ignorance of our prehistory on this planet, so it may be that we are kept in ignorance of our connections with the Earth satellite, the Moon, and with the planet Mars. And Richard Hoagland's done fantastic work in revealing that mystery.
Though you're a believer, obviously, in high technology from ancient civilizations, do you also believe the possibility that we were visited by ETs or that they're out there at all?
I think the universe is filled with life. That's my instinct. That's my guess. I suspect that a lot of the phenomena that are put down to so-called extraterrestrials, who are beings, physical beings just like us, coming from other planets on the other side of the galaxy and mastering the crossing of interstellar space, that's a hypothesis. I think we may be dealing with interdimensional contacts. We may be dealing with beings who come to us from other levels of reality, not from this levels of reality. The UFO phenomenon is too well documented to be dismissed. The alien abduction phenomenon is too well documented to be dismissed. But exactly what's behind this phenomenon remains to be established. We may be jumping too rapidly to the conclusion that it is simply physical beings like us with higher tech. Maybe it's beings from other dimensions who are interconnected with us in certain ways, and that the abduction is not into a spaceship as such, but that the UFO is a vehicle for crossing the veil between dimensions. And that would explain why the UFO is such an elusive thing, why it may show up on a radar screen for a moment and then vanish, and why we have accounts down the ages. Shamans think they're abducted by spirits. In the Middle Ages, people thought they were abducted by fairies and taken off to another world. Today, we think it's aliens. Actually, we don't know what this is. We should withhold judgment and consider the possibility that it may be even more mysterious than aliens. It may be interdimensional visitors that we're interacting with here, and who may be the ancient teachers of mankind.
Is your support system, is it growing now as opposed to back in 1995?
Growing enormously. I interact very extensively on Facebook, and my author Facebook page is linked off the opening page of my website, grahamhancock.com. Right. And I found that the support I get from the big community that's gathered around me on Facebook is incredibly important to me, that I'm constantly given new links, new information that I didn't know, suggestions of areas to research, and I do my best. It's not possible to respond to every comment because there are thousands, but I do my best to interact with this growing community. And what I love about it is it cuts out the big media. I don't need the big media. I don't need the national newspaper, or I don't need NBC. I've got my direct contact with my community, with my readers, and I can communicate directly with them through the medium of Facebook and the internet. And the internet is a huge instrument of liberation of information and of ideas in our world today.
And it's getting bigger and bigger. We're going to be back in a moment. We're going to use Skype. We're going to Europe, and we're going to go to the rest of the calls in just a moment. And, of course, our guest, Graham Hancock, we're talking about his work, Fingerprints of the Gods and War God as well. Let's come back in a moment. We'll take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Graham Hancock with us. Let's go to the phones here, our final segment. We're going to go to Skype, Graham. Mm-hmm. Vedran is there in Croatia for us. Go ahead, Vedran, go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Norrie. Hi, Mr. Hancock.
Hello.
Hi. I must say I'm really honored to speak to my favorite radio host and favorite author. Well, I have two questions for Mr. Hancock. The first one is there a connection of ancient sites and Freemasonry? And the second is, what is your stand on aliens, current, not ancient, and their connection with ayahuasca experiences?
Yes. Well, thank you. Those are two very interesting questions. Yes, I do believe there is a connection with Freemasonry and an ancient lost civilization. I think Freemasonry is one of the vehicles today best described as a society with secrets rather than a secret society, which has carried down the high wisdom of antiquity into the modern world. And preserved it and maintained it. I think that not all Freemasons are connected to these secrets. For many Freemasons, it's simply a social club. But at the higher, more esoteric levels, I think there's no doubt that they are the guardians of ancient secrets from the past. I'm not a Freemason myself. I don't join organizations or societies because I believe my role is to be a free and independent author. But I recognize that Freemasonry is carrying down a body of secret and esoteric lore from remote prehistory. As to your question about aliens, I think that we'll never get to grips with the mysterious phenomenon of UFO abductions and what are defined as ET contacts today until we get into the mystery of consciousness. There is no doubt that in deeply altered states of consciousness brought on perhaps by the consumption of the Amazonian brew known as ayahuasca, which means the vine of souls, or by direct inhalation of DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which, by the way, is also a natural brain hormone that we all produce in our own bodies. The work of Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico giving DMT to human volunteers, more than half of his volunteers had experiences that were identical to the experiences that are described as UFO abductions or alien abductions. And Rick Strassman is very clear at the end of that research that that didn't mean those experiences were unreal or that they were just generated in the brains of those individuals. The suggestion is that the brain is more like a receiver of consciousness, and that what DMT does, whether produced naturally by the body or whether smoked or given in a medical experiment at the University of New Mexico, what it does is retune the receiver wavelength of the brain and allow us to gain access to other levels of reality which are normally closed off to our senses. And it may be that UFO abductees are people who spontaneously overproduce endogenous DMT in the pineal gland and gain access to other levels of reality, totally real experiences, but not at this level of reality, at a different level of reality, more to do with parallel dimensions than anything else. And that's why I think we need to keep an open mind to what the so-called ET experience is. It could be much more mysterious than just high-tech beings coming from other planets. We could be making contact with the intelligent inhabitants, intelligent entities from other dimensions. And the fact that we can do so by altering our state of consciousness opens up intriguing areas for research, which our society should be embracing urgently, I believe.
When we talked a little bit about Quetzalcoatl and the Aztecs, who do you think he was? I mean, he obviously didn't fit in with the Aztecs. Who was he?
I think Quetzalcoatl was one of those survivors of a lost civilization. I think the story of Quetzalcoatl in Mexico is actually 12,000 years old. And there are carvings in stone at La Venta on the Gulf of Mexico where we see images of these bearded Caucasian-looking individuals who look nothing like Native American peoples, and at Monte Albán down near Oaxaca on the other side of Mexico. We see these figures that I describe as mysterious strangers in the oldest archaeological levels of Mexico and always associated with the imagery of the feathered serpent. And I think what is being preserved here is a memory of civilizing heroes who came to the land that we now call Mexico following that great cataclysm more than 12,000 years ago and left this tradition behind, and the tradition was later absorbed into all manner of myths and legends and was still alive at the time of the Aztecs, and they felt that this individual, this entity who was a god of peace, was going to return. Their mistake was confusing Cortez for that god of peace because of his superficial resemblance. In fact, Cortez was a man of war, and a Machiavellian player who completely outmatched the Aztecs in every level of ruthlessness and cruelty. And one of the things I feel about this story of Quetzalcoatl, which stands for a high ideal of human civilization, is we got it wrong at the time of the Spanish conquest of Mexico. And I hope that a time will come when we can get it right, when we can return to the principles of peace and decency and a high level of consciousness that Quetzalcoatl represents.
Let's go to Tim now in Racine, Wisconsin, with Graham Hancock. Hi, Tim. Go ahead.
Hey, how you doing, Graham? And how you doing, George?
I just want to say
thanks for letting me come on the show, you and Tom. I guess my question is, do you see like a meteor hitting Earth? And if so, would there be any good scenario where it hit? Like, say, if it hit in the deepest part of the ocean, would you still have like a big freeze or whatever you said? I take my answer off the show.
The evidence is overwhelming that we're not talking about a meteor, which is a relatively small thing. We're talking about a comet which broke into multiple fragments, and some of those fragments may have been a kilometer across, which hit the Earth 12,980 years ago. And the evidence is growing, and I cite the excellent work of Randall Carlson here. The evidence is growing that that impact was primarily with the ice cap on top of North America, and that ice cap was still more than a mile deep at the time. That's why we don't see huge craters in the Earth itself, because the crater was made in the ice cap, and just an ocean-sized amount of water of ice was turned into water instantly boiled into water by this comet impact, which caused huge outburst floods coming off the ice cap, and the traces of which can still be seen in the Pacific Northwest, in America, and in Canada, where you have these huge, just house-sized boulders strewn across the valleys that were carried down in these outburst floods. And yes, I think there's no doubt that some of the impacts were in the ocean as well, and they caused tsunamis. So you have floods coming down off the ice cap, and you have tsunamis coming up to the land from the ocean, and altogether you're facing the most horrendous moment in the living memory of the human species.
We go next to Ceylon in Eugene, Oregon. Welcome to the program. You're on. Hi there.
Hello, George and Graham.
Hi, Ceylon.
All right. I was curious if Graham has ever read Dr. Santos's book, The Lost Continent Finally Found.
Yes, I have. I have that book right here on the floor of my office at the moment. And, of course, he is looking at Southeast Asia, and he is looking at the area that I referred to as the Sunda Shelf, which includes Indonesia, where we have this amazing site called Gunung Padang that I'm going to be visiting at the beginning of December, which has recently been demonstrated to be more than as much as 20,000 years old. So, yes, I think his work is very important, and that whole area that the geologists call the Sunda Shelf was an area that was a continent-sized landmass that was above water during the Ice Age, and that was submerged very rapidly around 13,000 years ago. And Dos Santos has done some excellent work on that, and I intend to refer to that work in the sequel to Fingerprints of the Gods.
Graham, you looked at demons in your latest work as well. Tell me your interest there.
Well, I think that we have to accept that reality is much more mysterious than it at first appears to be. We're taught very much, it's part of the delusion that is foisted upon us as human beings, that we're just material beings, that there's nothing more to us than our bodies, that even consciousness itself is just, according to mainstream science, consciousness is just supposed to be an accidental byproduct of brain activity. And I think mainstream science is completely wrong on that. I think that reality is deeply mysterious and multi-layered, and that we have to take account. The word supernatural is a word loaded with implications which perhaps we don't need. Maybe all of this is natural, but there are parts of nature that we don't yet understand, which we refer to as the supernatural. So we are very much focused on the material level of reality, but I think we're making a mistake if we think that consciousness is an accidental product of material processes. I think consciousness is fundamental to reality, and that it is fundamentally non-physical in form, and that there are intelligences and there are entities which interact with us at the level of consciousness. And these have been spoken about throughout human history in the simple language of angels and demons. that there are beings that seek to nurture the divine spark within us, that seek to grow the light within mankind, that seek to bring out the best in us, and that there are entities that are dark and evil and seek to bring out the wicked side of mankind. And our predicament is to make choices between these two levels of inquiry. I have a great friend, James Tiberon, who refers to our life on Earth as a university of duality. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that idea of the university of duality, that we're here to learn from duality, and that the function of angels and demons is to provide us with these choices, and that we define ourselves by our choices. And what we desperately need to do now is to wake up and choose the light. We need to choose the light as individuals, as species. We as individuals cannot change the world, but we can change how we relate to one another. We can relate to one another with love, with decency. We can seek to nurture our fellow man rather than to take from our fellow human beings. And if we do that, if we all do that at the individual level, then we'll be making a choice for the light. And that choice for the light will illuminate the whole world.
Well said, Graham. Let's go to Juneau, Alaska. Jeff, let's get you in. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Graham. Hey, Graham, number 17 on my bucket list. Have a conversation on the phone with Graham Hancock. I can check that off.
Hey, I'm so pleased that you can check off number 17 on your bucket list. Good to talk to you.
I'm so glad. Hey, you know, I want you to comment on a couple things. I had a thought when you were mentioning your new book. I just recently was my birthday on the 8th, and I went on YouTube and watched this movie, Apocalypto, by Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
The description of your book there just ends right where your book starts.
Well, yeah, my book is Apocalypto ends with the arrival of the Spanish, and my book begins with the arrival of the Spanish. But Apocalypto is a fantastic movie, in my view, and it accurately depicts the horrific situation of human sacrifice. And the two central characters of my novel, Malinal and a young witch called Tozi, meet one another in the fattening pen at the foot of the Great Pyramid of Tenochtitlan, right, awaiting human sacrifice. I mean, imagine that. The Aztecs actually used to fatten their victims for sacrifice before they sacrificed them. Imagine the horror of confronting such a death, and the courage that it takes to break away from that and to get away from that. And that's why I think that this woman, Malinal, who's a true historical figure, who became the mistress of Cortez, who became the interpreter of Cortez, she's reviled as a traitor in Mexico today because she's regarded as having given Mexico to Cortez. But in fact, I think her objective was to bring down the Empire of Terror that was ruled by Moctezuma, the Aztec Empire of Terror, which is so well represented in that film, Apocalypto.
You still there?
Good.
Okay, Jeff, thank you. Let's go to Rob in Vancouver, Canada. Okay, Robbie, go ahead.
Absolute honor to speak with you tonight. Thank you. I know you're short on time, so I'll keep it quick.
Sure.
Your book on DMT, absolutely incredible. I can't say too enough about it. Have you ever combined your work on DMT and experimentation, and that combined with, you know, spiritual places, with archaeological areas, you know, places of importance or significance spiritually?
I think the Amazon jungle is one of those places, a great spiritual reservoir left on our planet, a sacred realm. And I have drunk ayahuasca, in which the active ingredient is DMT, in the Amazon. I have not yet taken DMT either in smoked form or in the form of ayahuasca in a place like the Great Pyramid, for example. And that's something I would very much like to do in the future, because I think the Great Pyramid was built as a device for altering consciousness. And this is all about altering consciousness and helping us to understand the mystery of our own consciousness. And again, this is something that our society is wholly opposed to. And when we see our society wholly opposed to adults exercising sovereign choice over their own consciousness, we realize that our society is making a huge mistake. If I, as an adult, am not free to make sovereign choices over what I wish to experience with my own consciousness while doing no harm to others, then I can't claim to be free in any way. And it's part of the mechanism of control in our society that we are supposedly not allowed to have these experiences.
We're in the final moments with Graham Hancock. His website, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. His works, Fingerprints of the Gods. He's working on a sequel there, War God as well. And you'll get a signed little sticker that you can put into your book. And it says, good as gold. Let's go to Nancy in Woodside, California. We'll get you in here. Nance, go ahead.
You're absolutely awesome, wonderful. I can't wait to get your book. I wanted to say I went down the stairs of Chichen Itza, the pyramid, and there was a little old priest there. He'd been there all his life. His father had been there before him. He asked me if I'd like to walk with him. Mm-hmm. I walked with him. We went down toward the ball court. On the left, I saw a temple. I said, that's where Quetzalcoatl was. He said, how did you know? Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know how I know, but I know that's what it is. And he said, how did he get there? And I said, he came there on a spaceship.
Interesting.
Right.
Interesting. A South American shaman called Pablo Amaringo, who I knew, suggested to me that the vehicles that we call spaceships are really vehicles for traveling between dimensions. So let's keep open to that idea as well.
That's always a possibility as well, Graham, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's fascinating, thinking of all those possibilities. Well,
yeah. Let's keep open to all possibilities when confronted by mystery.
It is truly mind-boggling to try to just think back at what this civilization, what this planet might have been like back 13,000
years ago. We need a conversation about this. We need a conversation, and this is what the Internet is brilliant at doing, is opening up the conversation and allowing many voices rather than just the voices of the hierarchy to speak. I hope listeners will visit my website, go to the message boards there, look at the news desk. My website is a center for this conversation about the mystery of our past.
Super. Graham, once again, thanks for being on the program. And when your new work comes out, Magicians of the Gods, make sure you're back on, okay?
I will do that with pleasure, George. Delight to talk to you.
You got it. Graham Hancock, he is always a home run, as we say. He's one of the best. Look, our next program, of course, we've got Catherine Austin Fitz for a couple hours, and, of course, a little surprise for you with James Von Prague later on. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, we'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.